Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This is WNYC. I'm Mark Garber. This weekend's protest march on Staten Island is just the latest in the tortured history of racial unrest in New York City. It takes place 25 years to the day after a notorious attack in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, where a young black man named Yusuf Hawkins was surrounded by a white mob and shot dead. What followed were years of fiery protests, led by Reverend Al Sharpton, who spoke at Hawkins' funeral.
I don't know who shot Yusuf, but the system loaded the gun.
WNYC's Jim O'Grady went to Bensonhurst this week and found that some tensions remain the same, even as the neighborhood has changed.
Maximo Abril has lived in Brooklyn for 45 years, the last five in Bensonhurst, a working-class neighborhood of small homes and tidy shops. He stopped to talk near his apartment on 67th Street, around the corner from the spot on 20th Avenue where Yusuf Hawkins died.
Who?
Yusuf Hawkins.
Yusuf Hawkins was 16 when he came to Bensonhurst on a summer night in 1989 to check out a used car. He was a black kid in a neighborhood that was almost completely white, a largely Italian-American enclave where young men fiercely guarded their turf. Hawkins got off at the 20th Avenue N train stop, and he didn't get very far before a mob of young men with baseball bats cornered and beat him. One of them pulled out a gun and shot him. Maximo Abril looks puzzled by this story.
This is a very peaceful neighborhood. There is a synagogue right there. I live next to it. Chinese people, Arabic people, Italians. There is this little park here.
You know what happened in this park 25 years ago?
No, I had no idea. I remember. I wasn't here.
Al Sharpton was stabbed.
In this park? I find it really, really... it boggles my mind, you know.
Sharpton was in the schoolyard of PS205 about a year and a half after Hawkins' death, preparing to protest because only one man from the mob that killed Hawkins, Joey Fama, had been convicted of murder. Sharpton was mingling with about 200 marchers when a 27-year-old white man in a Yankees jacket walked up and, without saying a word, shoved a 5-inch steak knife into Sharpton's chest. Sharpton was seriously injured and recovered at Coney Island Hospital, where city leaders visited his bedside. In that playground, on that January day, Sharpton turned the corner in his transformation from rabble-rouser to civil rights leader and cable TV host. Today, that schoolyard is where the neighborhood's Chinese-American teens get together for pickup basketball.
The neighborhood is changing.
How so?
So now it's Chinese people.
That's Al. He didn't want to give his last name, but he said he was born on a farm in Italy and then set down roots in Bensonhurst 45 years ago. He's sitting on a stoop with a group of other old-timers. None of them are happy to be reminded of Yusuf Hawkins.
It's a long time ago. Why you going to want to keep it up it again?
Why
you want to pick it up it again?
25 years ago.
They tell me to move on down the block, where I come across more stoop sitters, among them longtime Bensonhurst residents Angie and Mary Ellen.
I don't think much of Al Sharpton. I just don't.
Why not?
Well, I'm going to put it to you this way. If a black person killed me, do you think Al Sharpton would help me?
Absolutely not. He never stuck up for a white person.
Mary Ellen is 93 and has lived her whole life in Bensonhurst.
He had a whole crew, and they started a whole riot here. It was terrible.
But he was stabbed.
He was stabbed. He should have been killed.
There you go.
It was people like me that would have killed him.
It takes a moment for that thought to sink in.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, July 25, 2019. So I have been told. I am a little sick. Been hanging around lots of smaller children and just seeing how the germ spread. One of them got sick, got several others sick, and Gus T included. So I am persevering as best I can. Hate being sick in the summertime. Anywho, we're still doing the book club. Session number 4, Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear, Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence. I shared a video that Mr. De Becker did with Oprah Winfrey talking about domestic abuse. Shared it on social media earlier today. You can check it out. It's from, I think, like 2008, 2010, when he did an appearance on her broadcast. The audio segment that we started with today that was referencing Al Sharpton, I played that clip because Al Sharpton was referenced in last week's portion of the reading. Specifically, to make sure that we have context, he said, attention seeking, grandiosity, entitlement, and rejection are often linked. Think of someone you know who is always in need of attention, who cannot bear to be alone or to be unheard. Few people like being ignored, of course, but to this person, it will have a greater meaning. Imagine Al Sharpton or Rush Limbaugh unable to garner attention by methods they do today, believing they deserve it, knowing they need it, and committed to being seen and listened to, they might strongly resist a loss of attention. Now take that in context with the audio segment we just heard about white people wishing death on Al Sharpton, him being stabbed, and them being disappointed that it wasn't a fatal stabbing. I will rest there. We will go ahead and get started. This is Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 1.
Chapter 8. Persistence, persistence. That's what happens when you're angry at people. You make them part of your life. Garrison Keillor. In America, persistence is a bit like pizza. We didn't invent it, but we've certainly embraced it. We promise our children that persistence will pay off. We treat it as an attribute of success, and we compliment the people who hang in there against all odds. However, when persistence is unwanted, those same people we praised can plague our lives. Few situations are more confounding than dealing with people who refuse to let go. We try to predict what they might do next. We worry that they might get angry or dangerous, and we agonize over what strategies will make them stop whatever it is they feel so compelled to continue doing. Imagine that this happened to you instead of a client of mine. You and your spouse attend a seminar, and an acquaintance there introduces you to Tommy, a preppy-looking, energetic young man. When told about the upcoming expansion of your travel agency business, the young man lights up with enthusiasm. This chance meeting may not sound like the start of a nightmare, but that's exactly what it was for Mike Fetter and his wife Jackie. Over the chatter of the seminar, Tommy told them some of his ideas about the travel business. "I've always been interested in unconventional travel packages, and it's clear that people are moving away from the big hotels kind of thing, more toward camping and rafting and hiking. I have some packaging ideas that I know will double any agency's sales. I just haven't found the right partners to kick it off." He told the Fetters about selling father-son vacations by marketing to lists gathered from Little League organizations. "I work with some of these teams, and the parents put in a lot of time with their children, so they're obviously willing to invest money in enjoyable activities. The leagues are well organized, so the packages could be offered through their newsletters and meetings. Plus, you can get one father in a group and offer him incentives to sign up others. Jackie told Tommy she liked the family aspect of the idea. Mike said it sounded interesting. Good nights all around, and that was that. 2 days later, Tommy called Mike at his successful 75-person travel agency. He'd gotten Mike's number from the woman who introduced them, and he was following up on the business discussion we started. He wanted to have just a brief meeting. I could stop by today. 10 minutes is all I need, I promise. Rather than hurt his feelings, Mike agreed. 2 o'clock? 2 o'clock. Mike was on a long-distance call at 2 o'clock, so Tommy was kept waiting a few minutes. He seemed a bit put out by this. I thought we agreed to 2 o'clock. Oh, yeah, sorry, I've been working on a 40-person Africa excursion. Why am I making excuses to this guy? Mike wondered. It was a good question. The 10 minutes Tommy requested turned to 20. He had put together some material on his idea, and it was actually impressive, not so much the quality, but the quantity. He had obviously put a good deal of effort into it. Tommy said, "When we really clicked on this the other night, I got to thinking." And then his drop-by visit became a formal proposal. He would take a leave of absence from, Mike never did hear where Tommy worked, and he'd organize some father-son package tours to Yosemite. If it didn't succeed, Mike would pay him nothing, and if it did succeed, Tommy would get a percentage. When Mike told him he didn't normally work with outside agents, Tommy said he understood. I can join the team full time. When Mike told him there wasn't an opening, Tommy said, Oh, I can start anyway, and then we'll formalize it when something opens up. Persistent, Mike thought. Mark of those who succeed. Indeed. It was the mark of something, but not success. It was refusing to hear no, a clear signal of trouble in any context. 40 minutes into the meeting, Listen, Tommy, my best agent Marlene might be leaving in the next few months. She's getting married, and if that happens, I'll call you and we can revisit the matter. Tommy was disappointed that there wasn't a more concrete result, but said he'd be in touch to explore ways to move into the next inning. He called a week later and asked if Mike had made any decisions. Decisions about what? Nothing's really changed, Tommy. Marlene and her fiancé haven't set a date yet. And brush off. Brush off. Tommy ended with, Well, say hi to Jackie. This call gave some clues to another feature of those who don't let go. Projecting onto others commitments that were not expressed and are not present. The next day, Marlene asked Mike a bit hesitantly if he had a friend named Tommy. He had called and was wondering about her marriage plans. He had asked if she had even a ballpark idea of when she'd be leaving because Mike and I are trying to get to the next inning. Within 5 minutes, Mike had Tommy on the phone. Listen, you're a nice kid. I know you're just excited about the business, but I have to be clear with you. If we ever want to pursue your idea, and if it fits into our plans, I will call you. There's no need to call me anymore, and I certainly don't think you should have called Marlene. Understand? Tommy didn't seem at all dejected. Oh, I understand completely. Sorry for the confusion. I just thought I should get a time frame from her so I'd be ready to come to work. That's all. No big deal. I won't bug her again. It sounded as if he'd gotten it until he added, She said about 8 weeks, so I'll plan for that. Well, listen, Tommy, don't plan for anything. The travel business isn't like that. You never know what might happen. I hope our paths cross sometime, and I wish you all the luck in the world, and thanks again for your suggestions. Finally, that was that. What a persistent guy, Mike thought. But I'm sure he got the message. About 3 months later, Mike came back from lunch to find 3 messages from Tommy on his voicemail. Mr. Persistent. Before Mike got around to calling him back, Tommy was on the line again. He seemed agitated. That was really kind of a surprise, Mike, and not a good surprise, more like a shock. When I called this morning to touch base, they told me Marlene had been gone for 2 weeks. 2 weeks! We had an agreement, you know. So I was a little disappointed. I can't believe we lost 2 valuable weeks. I'm very committed to making this idea work, and I put a lot more time into it, refining things. It's really come a long way. I sure hope you haven't hired anybody to replace Marlene. Mike felt bad for the guy because it obviously meant a lot to him. How to let him down easy. Well, first of all, Marlene's position is not filled yet. Why'd I say that? But that's not the point. We didn't have an agreement. We had a chat, really. Well, maybe that's what you think it was, but I put my heart and soul into this thing. You know, I thought you'd have the kind of commitment it takes to stick with something, but maybe you don't. An opening, Mike thought. Maybe I don't, Tommy, so let's just agree to go our separate ways and chalk it up to experience. I'm sorry you went to so much trouble. Mike hung up. The next day, Tommy called again, twice, but Mike didn't return the calls. One of the messages said it was urgent. But what could be urgent with somebody you hardly know? Tommy left 5 more messages that week, and Mike finally discussed it with his wife. I don't feel like I led him on, but obviously I must have said something or done something that gave him all these hopes. I don't know what else to tell him, and I can't just not return his calls. I don't want to get him angry. He's already angry, Jackie said wisely. He was angry the moment we didn't become his best friends and go into business with him. I don't think anything you can say will be heard by him the way you mean it to be. Jackie, like most women, had much more experience than Mike in dealing with unwanted persistence. She knew that maybe is sometimes perceived as definitely, that like can be taken as love, and that people who don't hear you don't hear you. You get to the point that it doesn't help to keep trying. In fact, it makes matters worse, because it encourages attachment when you are seeking detachment. If Tommy could read a lifelong partnership into almost nothing, then a response could be taken by him in who knows what way. Contact is fuel for the fire, and Tommy was someone who didn't need much fuel. I'll give it another week, and then if it doesn't stop, I'll call him back and lay it on the line. But Mike, you did that, Jackie reminded him. You told him point blank not to call you again. You said, let's go our separate ways. All that seems pretty clear to me. Jackie was right. If you tell someone 10 times that you don't want to talk to him, you are talking to him. 9 more times than you wanted to. If you call him back after he leaves 20 messages, you simply teach him that the cost of getting a call back is 20 messages. For 2 weeks, there were no calls, and Mike was glad it was finally over. But then another message. It's urgent I speak with you immediately. Mike felt that he really had to put a stop to this now. At each step, he was making predictions about how Tommy would respond, and he was doing it by applying his own standards for behavior. Mike reasoned that not calling back would be insulting, but that somehow calling back and being insulting would make things better, and that's what he decided to do. What is it with you, you flake? We aren't going to be working together, period. Do you hear me? That should have been clear, but you don't listen. I don't want to talk to you about it anymore, okay? Tommy reacted in a way Mike hadn't predicted. He said he was just calling to apologize because he didn't want to burn his bridges behind him. I still think we can hit a home run with this thing someday, he added. No, Tommy, you should move on to something else. If I hear of any interesting openings, I'll let you know. Oh, God, why did I say that? But this will be our last call, okay? Can we just leave it at that? Mike was asking, not telling. Finally, Mike thought he had gotten through to the guy. That night he told Jackie, I called that guy back today, and it turns out all he wanted to do was apologize. Jackie said, good. And I hope that's the last call you ever have with him. Of course it's the last call. He's apologized, and it's over. Until a week later, when there was a Federal Express envelope from Tommy. It contained a note requesting that Mike sign an enclosed letter of reference, which Tommy said would help him at his bank. Even though Mike had assured Jackie that he'd made his last call, he decided to respond to Tommy's request. To Mike's relief, he reached an answering machine and left this message. I don't feel comfortable signing the reference letter you sent, but I wish you the best of luck. People who refuse to let go often make small requests that appear reasonable, like Tommy's letter of reference, though the real purpose of such requests is to cement attachment or gain new reasons for contact. Within a few hours, Tommy left a message for Mike. I'm not surprised you didn't have the courage to talk with me directly. You know, it would have taken less time to sign that letter than it did to leave me your condescending message. No wonder you're in the travel business. Everybody wants to get away from you. Please mail the unsigned letter back to me. Unfortunately, Mike had thrown the letter away. Now Tommy had another issue to chew on. The next day, there was another message. No need to call back. I just thought I'd let you know. You are an asshole. I want that letter back. This was too much for Mike. He felt he had to take some real action now. It's at this point in these situations that a fascinating thing happens. The pursuer and the victim begin to actually have something in common. Neither wants to let go. The pursuer is obsessed with getting a response, and the victim becomes obsessed with making the harassment stop. What the pursuer is really saying is, I will not allow you to ignore me. He'll push buttons until one provokes a reaction, and then as long as it works, he'll keep pushing it. Guilt is usually first, then harassment, then insult. Each works for a while and then doesn't. When victims participate in this process, threats are not far behind. But Mike wasn't going to just sit around and do nothing. He called the person who had introduced them, told her the whole story, and asked for her help. Maybe you can get through to him and get him to leave me alone. The next day, Mike's voicemail had three messages from Tommy, one of them left at 2 a.m., Now you've ruined one of my best friendships, asshole. I don't know what lies you're spreading about me, but I demand an apology, a written apology. You are on notice. 2 days later, more messages, including one saying that Tommy was going to make a formal complaint, whatever that meant. Then a message saying, I'm going to book 20 bogus trips with your agency every month. You won't know what's me and what isn't. Then you'll learn not to make promises you never intended to keep. Jackie convinced Mike to keep the voicemail messages, but otherwise ignore them. The following week, another message came in saying if Mike would call and apologize, Tommy might accept that. But we're getting to the point that an apology won't be good enough. I like Jackie, and I'm sorry for all the trouble your stubbornness is going to bring her. Mike and Jackie finally ended up in my office, playing the tapes of the voicemail messages. By this time, they had already been to the police twice. Officers had visited Tommy and warned him to stop, but he actually got worse after that. To understand the police inclination toward direct intervention, one must recognize that in all cultures of the world, the role of police is to control conduct. Police are the enforcement branch of our society, and when people misbehave, it is police we expect to make them stop. That's usually fine, except in cases in which police contact actually encourages the very behavior it is meant to deter. When nothing else worked, the police told Mike to get a restraining order, but Jackie convinced him to wait until after they had discussed it with me. Sitting on a couch in my office, Mike made it clear that he was near the end of his rope. He wanted me to send some people over to convince Tommy to cut it out, even though that hadn't worked when their friend did it or when the police did it. He said he wanted me to explain the facts of life to Tommy in no uncertain terms. I told Mike that all terms were uncertain to Tommy. But if he knows he can get into trouble, Mike argued. It's logical for him to stop. Tommy doesn't have a track record for being logical. He doesn't speak the same language we do, and we can't teach it to him with logic. If he were reasonable, he wouldn't have pursued this behavior in the first place. There is no straight talk for crooked people. Mike argued more. I don't want this guy thinking he can get away with harassment. Jackie responded before I could. If we can't control what he does, we certainly can't control what he thinks. I suggested, with Jackie's quick agreement, that if Mike did not respond, Tommy would eventually turn his attention elsewhere. That may take some time and some patience, and I know it isn't easy, but efforts to change his mind or to change him are the opposite of what you want. You don't want him improved. You want him removed. You want him out of your life. There's a rule we call engage and enrage. The more attachment you have, whether favorable or unfavorable, the more this will escalate. You see, we know a secret, and that's that you are never going to work with him or be friends with him or want anything to do with him. Since anything less than that is not going to satisfy him, we already know that part of the outcome. He's going to be left disappointed and angry, and he is going to need to deal with that. If you talk to him, what you say becomes the issue. The only way you can have your desired outcome right now is to have no contact. Only then will he begin to find other solutions to his problems, which you can't help with anyway. As long as he gets a response from you, he is distracted from his life. If, however, you don't return the calls, then each time he leaves a message, he gets a message that you can resist his pursuit. Yeah, but the guy never stops, Jackie interjected. You haven't tested never yet, Mike. You haven't even tried 2 weeks. She was right. I explained that every time Mike called Tommy back or showed any detectable reaction to his harassment, this engaged him. With each contact, you buy another 6 weeks. I explained that the same concepts apply with romantic pursuers who don't let go, ex-boyfriends who don't let go, fired employees who don't let go, and all the other incarnations of don't let go. I wanted Mike to know that though Tommy was annoying, he wasn't unique. I asked Mike what he thought Tommy might do next. I have no idea. That's why I came to you. I waited. I guess he'll threaten some more. An exactly accurate prediction from someone who a moment before had no idea. Mike faced a type of situation that initially offers two widely different management plans. One, change the pursuer, or two, change the way the pursuer's conduct affects us. Under the first heading are such things as warnings, counter-threats, police interventions, and other strategies designed to control someone's conduct. Under the second headings are such things as insulating ourselves from hazard or annoyance, evaluating the likelihood of violence, and monitoring new communications. Under the second plan, we limit the impact the situation is allowed to have by limiting our fear and anxiety. We also limit impact on the pursuer by not responding. In this case, we agreed that my office would conduct a general background inquiry on Tommy, evaluate all the messages and information available thus far, and institute the following management plan. Mike would get a new voicemail extension. My office would check Mike's old voicemail every hour and forward to him all his messages, except those from Tommy. We would review, evaluate, and keep each message left by Tommy. I assured Mike and Jackie, between where we are now and his becoming violent, there would be several detectable warning signs. If there is anything that gives us the slightest reason to believe he might escalate beyond phone calls, we will contact you immediately. What impact a harasser has is one of the few things a victim can control. And from that day forward, Tommy's calls would have no impact whatsoever on Mike or Jackie. In the end, Tommy continued to call for 5 more weeks. He left many messages, including threats that Mike would have found hard to resist responding to. Mike had predicted that Tommy would only stop if someone made him stop. But in fact, the opposite was true. He would only stop if nobody tried to make him stop. This case could have been very different. Mike and Jackie might have gotten a restraining order, which is really the process of suing someone in civil court to leave you alone and stay away from you. Would Tommy have advanced or retreated? Who had more to lose, Tommy or Mike and Jackie? Had Tommy reacted favorably the other times Mike tried to put a cost on his conduct, enlisting Tommy's friend, sending the police, what would a lawsuit have done to Tommy's perceived justification? People in these very frequent situations, whether involving a former intimate partner, a former employee, or someone like Tommy, wrestle with their options, rarely seeing that doing nothing provocative is an option too. Everyone they know has a suggestion. He'll stop if you just return his call. All he wants is to be recognized. Maybe you need to have someone else call and say you're out of town. Try changing your number. He'll get the message. There is an almost irresistible urge to do something dramatic in response to threats and harassment, but often appearing to do nothing is the best plan. Of course, that isn't really doing nothing. It is a reasoned management plan and a communication to the pursuer every bit as clear as direct contact. This approach is a real test of patience and character for victims, but it's often the fastest way to end harassment. The way a friend of mine describes his approach to work offers a valuable analogy for managing some interpersonal situations. I have two drawers in my desk. One is for the things I must do something about. The other is for the things time will take care of. Time will take care of most people who refuse to let go. Some of these persistent people suffer from delusions, the very definition of which explains why they don't let go. A false belief that cannot be shaken, even in the face of compelling contrary evidence. Most harassers, however, have something less than a delusion, something we might call an alternate perception or an unreasonable opinion. The resolution they seek is usually not attainable, and these people are so confounding because the original issue they cling to is seen from their unusual perspective. We may think Mike made no promises to Tommy, but Tommy can say he feels otherwise. He can even base his feelings on objective facts and statements that were actually made. But it's the outcome he desires and his way of getting there that established Tommy as an unreasonable person. Professor Mary Rowe of MIT is among the few academics who have studied these cases. She identifies as a warning sign the extreme nature of a desire, for example, a desire for total physical and emotional control of another person, or the total acceptance of a proposal. She also describes an extraordinary sense of entitlement, such as, she must talk with me, the department must let me work on that project, or I refuse to vacate my office. When a person requires something unattainable, such as total submission to an unreasonable demand, it's time to stop negotiating, because it's clear the person cannot be satisfied. Getting pulled into discussions about the original issue misses the point. It's as if one party has come to the table wanting $1 million and the other party is prepared to give $5 or no dollars. In such situations, there is nothing to negotiate. In some cases, a person's desired outcome can't even be determined, much less attained. What would Tommy have been satisfied with near the end of his harassment campaign? An apology? A successful partnership with Mike? I don't know, and I don't think Tommy knew either. Professor Rowe brings into focus the great internal conflict for such people, explaining that they certainly do not want to lose, but may also be unable to stand winning in the conventional way, since that would mean the fight is over. Of course, it isn't over until all participants are out of the ring. And as long as people try to change the pursuer or satisfy the pursuer, it goes on. Most often, the fear of violence lurks in the shadows and keeps people trying. But was Tommy likely to be violent? Let's look at him in terms of our four general elements of violence. Jaka. Perceived justification. Tommy may have felt provoked when Mike called his friend, but he did not demonstrate that he felt violence was justified. Perceived alternatives. People likely to use violence perceive few or no alternatives, but Tommy's continuing calls proved that he saw many alternatives, interfering with Mike's business, harassing, threatening, etc. Perceived consequences. Those likely to be violent perceive that it will bring them tolerable or even favorable consequences. Tommy showed no indication that he was willing to give up his freedom, an intolerable consequence to him, by escalating to violence. Interestingly, the consequences of threatening, including being visited by police, were clearly tolerable to him. Perceived ability. Those who use violence perceive that they have the ability to deliver it, but Tommy said nothing and did nothing that indicated he felt that ability. Though victims understandably find them confounding, most people who refuse to let go are highly predictable. It's perhaps too glib to say they continue until they stop, but that's basically what happens in the vast majority of cases, unless they are engaged. To accurately predict the little behaviors along the way, one must understand the languages of entitlement, attachment, and rejection. Above all, one must see the situation in the context of this culture, which teaches the myth that persistence pays. The earliest version most of us hear is, in America, anyone can be president. When in fact, only one person can be president, and 240 million others cannot. F. Scott Fitzgerald said something about persistence that all the Tommies could benefit from. Vitality shows not only in the ability to persist, but in the ability to start over. No group knows more about being persistently pursued than famous people, from the local prom queen to the politician to the internationally famous media figure. All can teach us something about persistence. A very famous media figure might have hundreds of persistent pursuers, literally hundreds of Tommies. People in Mike and Jackie's situation often wonder what it would be like to have unlimited resources to influence, control, and punish an unwanted pursuer. They even fantasize about how simple the situation would be if they had the police, the courts, the government on their side. But it's a fantasy. Because no matter how famous the victim, no matter how powerful the advocates, it simply isn't always possible to control the conduct of other people. Canadian singer Anne Murray experienced a case that proves this point decisively. She was stalked for years by a man who was given scores of court orders that he violated, arrested over and over again, and eventually put in prison for 6 years. Upon his release, a judge again ordered him to leave Murray alone. But within his first few months of freedom, the stalker violated the court order more than 200 times. John Searing, a 36-year-old salesman of art supplies from New Jersey, was just as persistent in efforts to get what he wanted from Johnny Carson. In 1980, he wrote to The Tonight Show asking if they would let him do something he had wanted to do since he was a boy. Yell, "Here's Johnny," on the air some night. In response, he got an 8x10 photo of Johnny Carson. Though most people would have gotten the message, Searing wrote again and then again. After a while, he got a form letter from a staff person thanking him for his proposal and explaining that it would not be feasible. But Searing kept writing. He enclosed audio tapes of himself doing impressions of Jimmy Stewart and Richard Nixon. Their famous voices made the same request. Let John Searing yell, "Here's Johnny." This went on for a long while, long enough, in fact, for Searing to write more than 800 letters. Tonight Show staffers, tempered by decades of experience with persistent letter writers, didn't become alarmed. They didn't call the police to make it stop. They did, however, call John Searing to ask why it was so important to him. "Because nothing in life means more to me," he told them. Soon after that call, an amazing thing happened. The Tonight Show said yes to the request they had ignored 800 times. Searing was flown to Los Angeles, given a dressing room with his name on the door, and like something out of a dream, his dream, he was walked into the studio. He watched from the side of the stage as Ed McMahon introduced Johnny Carson with the famous words, "Here's Johnny." "But what about me?" Searing wondered. he was told to be patient. After the first commercial, Johnny Carson explained to the audience about John Searing and his hundreds of letters, and then Searing was introduced to America. He sat next to the famous man at the famous desk for about 6 minutes, explaining why he had been so persistent and what it meant to him. Carson directed Searing to a microphone and then went back behind the curtain. Searing was handed a script from which he enthusiastically read, "From Hollywood, The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. This is John Searing, along with Doc Severinsen and the NBC Orchestra, inviting you to join Johnny and his guests, Danny DeVito, from the San Diego Zoo, Joan Embry, letter writer John Searing, and Adventures in the Kitchen with Doc." There was a drum roll. "And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny." Carson came through the curtain to great applause and gave Searing a simple instruction. "Now go and write no more." And that is exactly what happened. Searing went back to work selling art supplies. Persistent though he had been, his letters never contained anything sinister or foreboding. He had always maintained a job, had other interests, and above all, he never escalated the nature of his communications. While giving pursuers exactly what they want is not often my recommended strategy, particularly recognizing the impracticality of applying it regularly, it is interesting to note that The Tonight Show made no effort to stop Searing from writing letters. Johnny Carson and his staff knew that letters, no matter how frequent, can't hurt anyone, while starting a war can hurt everyone involved. Had Searing been left alone, he would likely have kept writing letters, maybe for years, maybe for his whole life, and that would have been fine. Our office has several cases of people who have written more than 10,000 letters to one media figure and never attempted an encounter. Those clients are entirely unaffected by the letters, which their staffs forward to us unopened, and which we then review. The issue, then, is not persistence, but knowing the differences between communications and behaviors that portend escalation, and those from which you can predict that a pursuer is likely to retreat or just fade away. In these situations, victims are understandably frustrated, to say the least, and they want something done to their pursuer to make him stop. The institutions of psychiatry, law enforcement, and government have proved that no matter what your resources, you cannot reliably control the conduct of all people. It's not fair, but it's so. My role is to increase safety and reduce fear, not to tell people what they want to hear. Still, there's always someone willing to do what a celebrity wants, whether or not it is the safest course. I can't recall how many times I have seen some private detective apply confrontational interventions and then feel these actions were justified by the fact that the pursuer's behavior ultimately got worse. Having guided the pursuer into a warlike stance, the detective will say, "Phew, it's a good thing we did all that stuff to him, because just look how serious a case this is. I told you something had to be done." Do they never wonder what might have happened if they had just left him alone? By way of analogy, when you're driving on a slippery mountain road at night, you don't manage the hazard by getting out and drying off the pavement. You slow down through the dangerous curves. When dealing with people who won't let go, that means having strategies in place to lessen the likelihood of unwanted encounters. You change what you can and stop trying to change what you cannot. A strategy of watch and wait is usually the wisest first step. But people frequently apply another management plan: engage and enrage. The option of engaging a pursuer will always be available to you, but once it's applied, you cannot simply go back to watching and waiting, even though you may find it wasn't so bad by comparison. Though Johnny Carson knew it, the lesson that persistence on its own is not sinister would come too late for another media figure, Los Angeles radio personality Jim Hicklin. Best known to listeners as a pilot commentator who advised on traffic conditions, he also reported on other newsworthy events from his helicopter. When he received some annoying letters from a fan, He quickly found people who told him what he wanted to hear. "We'll take care of it." They didn't. The first letter had arrived at the Hicklin residence near the end of August, 1971. The author was 45-year-old wimpy, nebbish Edward Taylor, whose story is best told through his letters. The first one was intended to be friendly and supportive. It was addressed, "Dear James," and signed, "Respectfully yours, Ed Taylor." Though Hicklin didn't answer the letter, more came. They contained praise, remembrances, compliments, and one even suggested that Jim Hicklin run for governor. Another read, "You are a star." Jim Hicklin was unaware that Taylor was a tireless letter writer who had been known to several prominent people in Los Angeles for years. Taylor's letters either amused or annoyed these people. Mostly, they were just ignored. But Hicklin didn't ignore the letters. Instead, he hired a pair of private detectives to resolve the matter. They made an unannounced visit to Taylor's home and gave him one clear order: stop sending letters. This intrusive intervention didn't stop the letters, but it did change them. The first letter following the visit from the detectives was 6 pages long. The penmanship was now erratic. There were many messy corrections, and all the friendliness and praise of the past was gone. "You have grievously offended me," wrote Taylor. "I have given much thought to your implied threat against me, your presumed paranoia, or your naivete, or your innocent receipt of a pack of rotten advice. Or is it that you are just simply insufferably arrogant?" This letter introduced a new theme that was to become the principal focus of Taylor's life for a year: litigation. It continued. "I am both flattered and impressed to have been investigated. The cue is about what? That is precisely why there are lawyers, and you need a good one badly. At Hicklin's earliest opportunity, it is imperative that he inform me in writing of the identity of his attorney." The next letter was to the general manager of the radio station Hicklin worked for. "There appeared at my residence 2 private detectives in the name of Golden West Broadcasting, the owner of the radio station. They came unannounced to interrogate me, relating to some very personal and confidential memoranda I have in past months sent to Hicklin. Your people admitted they were instructed by Jim Hicklin to call on me, unannounced, with no regard to my family, guests, responsibilities, or even the state of my health. It is harassment. It is a virulent invasion of one's privacy. It is threatening, it is intimidating, and it is wrong." Precisely of what reprehensible culpability does Jim Hicklin accuse me? Professionally and personally, it is very important to me that I know. And I shall. About a week later, Taylor sent the FAA the first of many letters calling into question Hicklin's competency to hold a pilot's license. "Until it has been established by your jurisdiction that Mr. Hicklin is of sound body and mind, I suggest he is a threat to life, property, and himself." Note that he had at this point introduced the concepts of threat and safety. Taylor next filed a civil complaint with a superior court demanding an apology from Hicklin. He wrote to the judge, "The referenced case has meant to scathingly denounce and repudiate the presumed right of one citizen to conspire to contravene the right of another's to free expression, to transmit mail, to be free from fear of retaliatory psychological assault, emasculation at the door to one's own home." This letter gives a good opportunity to see the situation from Taylor's perspective. He felt intruded upon, threatened, and, perhaps most importantly, emasculated. Recall the assumptions I said could be applied to most of us. We seek connection with others. We are saddened by loss and try to avoid it. We dislike rejection. We like recognition and attention. We will do more to avoid pain than we'll do to seek pleasure. We dislike ridicule and embarrassment. We care what others think of us. We seek a degree of control over our lives. The effort to deter Taylor by sending private detectives collided with most of these. He was seeking connection and then saddened by the loss of his chummy, albeit one-sided, relationship with Hicklin. He was rejected. He had reached the point where the situation could bring him no pleasure, and all he could do was try to stop the pain. He felt chastised and embarrassed. He felt that others would think less of him if he didn't reclaim his masculinity by getting an apology. Finally, he felt he had lost control over his life. One day, Hicklin made an on-air comment about people who start brush fires. They should be tied to a stake and left there. After hearing this, Taylor wrote that some teenager might prod his group into acting out the sick fantasy as broadcast by personality pilot reporter folk hero Hicklin. Law enforcement finds enough skeletal remains in the hills. It is bestial to hear one condone murder by the torch. Note the sinister nature of his references. They continued in Taylor's next complaint to the FAA, which was that Hicklin had buzzed his home in what he called a strafing mission. Is there a more barbaric, mindless, obscene act than a pilot who would aim an aircraft at defenseless humans on the ground for the sole purpose of harassment, by a pilot whose sole sick mission is to establish his dominance over his victims? Needless to say, the FAA did not, and could not, take any action that would have satisfied Taylor. Likewise, the court dismissed his suit. With his alternative shrinking, Taylor typed a 7-page memo recounting in detail each incident involving Hicklin. He stated that Hicklin used his helicopter as a weapon, and that aircraft in the hands of mentally unbalanced men constitute offensive weaponry. Let's stop and look at the context of the situation. At the start, it was simple. A famous person was sent some overly praising letters by a member of his audience. Though perhaps not written in a style that appealed to Hicklin, the letters were appropriate for the context. At the start, the situation was not interpersonal. But after the admirer was visited by intimidating men who warned him to stop writing letters, it became interpersonal. Jim Hicklin got the last thing he wanted, a relationship with Edward Taylor. They had become enemies. Hicklin, I could have understood your conduct had you come to my door with a .38 in hand rather than having sent two private detectives, like a strung-out queen. Now you've psyched up buddies to threaten my life. That's sad. Remember to call me Mister. The day he sent this letter, Edward Taylor did more than just write about a .38. He went out and bought one. Meanwhile, Hicklin decided to try his first strategy again. He asked the district attorney's office to send investigators and get Taylor to stop. They did visit him, but they did not get him to stop. Taylor told the district attorney's investigators that he was the victim of Hicklin's harassment, not the other way around. He feared that Hicklin may have hovered above his house in order to draw a map. He explained that he was so apprehensive of Hicklin's bizarre behavior that he always carried with him a note of explanation addressed jointly to the Los Angeles Police Department and the DA's office. Along with a note, he always carried the handgun. After he was warned by the DA's investigators, Taylor wrote to them, "When a complainant perceives that established authority does not care and or will not empathize with what it is like when one has his life threatened by a mindless, manipulative robopath, to experience the trauma of purchasing a .38 handgun in his 46th year in order to defend himself from a paid or emotionally involved assassin, to see a handgun on his desk during working hours, to see it again first thing in the morning upon awakening, and as the final objet d'etre upon retiring at night. Worst of all is to consider the nature of complainant's alleged provocation against respondent, to hear the latter tell it, male." All the information needed was in this letter. what Taylor projected onto Hickland, namely that he was an emotionally involved assassin, was actually at work inside him. As James Baldwin said, in the face of one's victim, one sees oneself. Though Taylor never made a threat to harm Hickland, the clear hazard can be gleaned from that letter, nonetheless, by applying the Jaca elements. Taylor felt he had justification to use violence, defending himself. He had few alternatives left. Established authority didn't care about him. The consequences of violence had become favorable because violence would stop the mindless robo-path. And finally, he had the ability to deliver violence. The gun. The visit from the DA's investigators, like the first visit from the private detectives, clearly had a major and unfavorable impact that Taylor had difficulty recovering from. The ultimate intrusion, the ultimate insult, was still to come. And from that one, Taylor would be unable to recover. One evening, while his elderly mother was visiting him, Taylor answered a knock at his front door. It was the police who, in front of his mother, arrested Edward Taylor. He was booked into Los Angeles County Jail for misdemeanor libel. Unable to contact anyone to bail him out over the weekend, he spent 3 days in jail. Home from jail, shaken more than even he realized, Edward Taylor could not get relief from his indignation about all that had happened. Now that there was a cost on his writing letters, he stopped writing them. Instead, he stewed, tried to sleep, tried to eat, and stewed some more. He couldn't find the life he'd had before all this started, such as it was, so he just sat at home listening to Jim Hicklin's radio show. In this sense, media figures are unavoidably adding some fuel to the fire just by being in the media. A person obsessed with a movie star, for example, might see her in magazines, on entertainment news programs, and talk shows. Ironically, even if he wants to, an obsessed person might find it hard to get away from the object of his pursuit. But soon Hicklin would be off the air. He and his wife were going on a vacation cruise, just as he had planned and just as he had announced over the radio. Jim Hicklin and his wife boarded the Italia cruise ship on April 2, 1973. Before leaving port, the Hicklins entertained friends who had come to see them off. But not everyone on board was a friend. In the presence of his wife, Jim Hicklin was shot to death by a man he'd never met and never spoken to. Edward Taylor had defended himself in the way he had obviously been thinking of for some time. Believing that others will react as we would is the single most dangerous myth of intervention. When people wanted to stop Edward Taylor's letters, they were certain a strong warning would do it. Then they were certain arrest would do it. But even his being arrested, tried, convicted, and incarcerated for life did not stop Edward Taylor's letters. He continued to write to the district attorney and others until the day he died in prison. People who refuse to let go are becoming more common, and each case teaches us the same valuable lesson. Don't engage in a war. Wars rarely end well because, by definition, someone will have to lose. In Predicting Violent Behavior, John Monahan explains that violence is interactional. The reaction of a potential victim of violence may distinguish a verbal altercation from a murder. As you have now learned from cases of public figure pursuers and other people who refuse to let go, the minute you get into it with someone, you are into it. And if you get angry, that all by itself is a kind of victory for him. Remember Tommy? In the course of a follow-up investigation, my office learned that he got a job with a bank, enjoyed a 3-month honeymoon there, and was fired for insubordination. He began a harassment campaign against the bank's personnel director that is still going on as I write this. The bank has threatened him with a lawsuit, and he has threatened them with everything he could think of. Tommy's former employers, like others concerned about violence from an angry employee, face situations that are highly predictable. Second only, in fact, to those between intimates. This ease of predictability makes some employers uncomfortable, because with ability comes responsibility. After you finish the next chapter, you'll have both.
Context of white supremacy. Just trying to read that last portion again. Okay. Context of white supremacy. So Gavin DeBecker, The Gift of Fear, will pick up on chapter 9, Occupational Hazards. That's where we'll start at. Audio segment number 2. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Wow. My question, I reckon, would be, what do people think of that as a strategy? And I guess I will concede or add that frequently on this program, planned ignoring is similar phrasing that sounds close to kind of what he was talking about. But what do people make of this strategy? Because almost the entirety of chapter 8 on just, you know, hey, sometimes you don't need to do a lot of responding. Sometimes the best thing to do, if it's a non-harmful act, to just ignore. You can observe, you can document that this is taking place, but, you know, sometimes it's best to not respond. Planned ignoring, as I said, sometimes we call that on this broadcast. What do people make of that, particularly given some of the types of situations that were presented? Does that sound sensible? Because it's almost like, you know, with the examples that he presented, that you might be inflaming the situation by responding sometimes. What do people make of that? That's one. Two, the Al Sharpton, and particularly he mentioned the word culture in the previous chapter, and talking about the culture that we're in that promotes this notion of persistence. The culture of white supremacy is why I have to go back to the segment on Al Sharpton, because in a book, The Gift of Fear, Al Sharpton in that segment was stabbed talking about, not rioting, talking about the death of Yusuf Hawkins, a black male who was killed by a gang of race soldiers, terrorists. That's something to be fearful of. White terrorism in all its manifestations. Al Sharpton also with Tawana Brawley, infamously. That's, oh man, talk about hate. Al Sharpton defending a black female who says NYPD's finest raped me. Oh, we don't want to hear from Al Sharpton. That is something to be fearful of, that I could be raped, terrorized by enforcement officials, and nothing could be done about this. In fact, you know, you could be scalded if you say something about this. Alton Maddox also with that case. I think he lost his ability to practice law for being associated with that case, if I'm not mistaken. He was also involved with the Central Park 5 case. But that is something to be fearful about. I don't think that context, that is the culture that we are in, the culture of white supremacy, racism. And it certainly hasn't been stated explicitly that you should have, or that should, hey, black people should be afraid of white people, given all of the things that have happened. Black people should be afraid. This case was right there. He talked about O.J. Simpson. We think there was a reference to the Central Park 5. No reference to Yusuf Hawkins. Black people should be afraid of white people. Rodney King was just 5 years out. No, black people should be afraid of white people, or it's right, it's logical that they would be fearful of white people. That is the culture that we are in, culture of fear, but that's not mentioned at all. We just get Al Sharpton and sly O.J. Simpson references. If folks have thoughts, comments on the first audio segment, *61, lines should be open if you have thoughts, questions. While folks are getting their thoughts together, I'll go back through my notes. I did not know about this assassination. The Hicklin assassination. I did not know about this at all. I guess this happened before I was born, so I don't know. Maybe this is not a big deal. I'll check information about that, but that is interesting. Like I said, the contrast that he kind of gives, because that was the entire chapter. That was all of chapter 8 was persistence and just given kind of revolving around these two different anecdotes where one person finally we say, hey, we're just not going to respond to these letters at all. And it fades away. The other scenario, the individual ramps up, gets, you know, private enforcement officials to pay a visit Edward Taylor to go visit him at his house. And then they say the next one was the enforcement officials arrested him in front of his elderly mother. I thought it was important that they said he felt Mr. Taylor felt emasculated in all of this. I think that often can be a trigger to white male violence. I would even say that might be Dr. Welsing moment, because that's what she talked about frequently with white genetic annihilation and with, even if I could go to Yusuf Hawkins, why you would have a case like that. White males needing to shore up their masculinity against the threat of black males. That's why you would have an incident. And I think he was beaten to death, if I'm not. They had bats and what have you and chased him. I might double check on the details, but Yusuf Hawkins. But that's the same thing, in my view. Let's see. But the emasculation of Edward Taylor, that was something that I thought was important and why he felt he needed to respond with violence against Mr. Hicklin, shot on April 2nd, 1973. The earlier case with, or I guess he did give a couple. He gave the case also with Johnny Carson. We had, make sure I get the name right, Searing, S-E-A-R-I-N-G, Searing, is writing all of these letters. We don't think it's a threat. It's not going to be harmful. And he, you know, eventually ends up getting on the Johnny Carson show. But most of it revolving around these two big incidents about assessing, I guess, threat using his using some of the code that he's given in the text and evaluating if this is a threat. If it's not going to be harmful, there's no indication of violence. As I said, you monitor, planned ignoring. You just monitor. It's interesting. And allowing things to unfold as they will. Like I said, that is a suggestion that's given out on workplace racism on a regular basis. Just saying, hey, I will document if it's a racist joke or something of that nature. That is one strategy that can be employed. So I can't really say that that's strange or unfamiliar, because that is something that it gets or at least I recommend on the broadcast on a pretty frequent basis. I think it can be successful. I do think, as he said, you kind of gauge, is there going to be immediate danger? Is there going to be immediate harm with what's taking place? Not always going to be the best strategy, but sometimes it can work well. Let's see. Going back. Yeah, I think the code, his Jaka code, as he calls it, it seems like he has lots of these. I posted a video where he was on Oprah Winfrey in like 2008, 2010. He was talking about this book, basically, or he was talking about domestic violence specifically. But he was promoting, I think he has a different code called Mosaic. You can check it out online, I think. It's supposed to be available for free, and it's supposed to be a threat assessment. It can be used. I'll pull it up myself. It's supposed to be used. You can make a threat assessment for a workplace environment. You can make a threat assessment for domestic abuse type situation. It's supposed to be very versatile. But he has lots of these types of codes that are used. I just read a report today where he was just hired by Jeff Bezos to do security and find out who did these leaks and leaked, text information from Mr. Bezos. Amazon right here in Seattle. But he has lots of these types of codes. That seems to be his security empire around having codes to assess threats, to assess danger, to assess the potential for violence and other security matters. But that seems to be kind of the core of what he does, making codes so that you can accurately predict, assess violence. Those are skills. I guess that would go to the core of why we're reading this book, because I think victims, Yusuf Hawkins, what I just said, Tawana Brawley, Al Sharpton, what are they talking about? Violence against black people, victims of racism. But that's why we're reading this book, and hopefully people are picking up some of the tidbits that are helpful in picking up some of those cues when we might be in danger. Star 6-1, if folks have any thoughts on first portion of the reading, if you think it makes sense. As I said, I'm just saying planned ignoring, because that's pretty much the language that I use, but talking about the same thing that he has presented, or at least that he presented in this portion. If you have someone that's being persistent but not harmful, that sometimes the best route can be to planned ignore. I'm not going to respond. We're not going to be enemies, not going to make a war out of this where somebody has to lose. No response. Is that sensible? What do folks think about that? Or other aspects that were presented? Because he did spend the entire chapter. I'm kind of looking back over that like, wow, he spent the whole chapter talking about persistence. And basically, like I said, revolving around these two examples. Maybe folks did not think that was the best way to present a book, but he pretty much did just present the whole chapter around that. Let's see, retired firefighter, did you have thoughts, questions, first portion of the reading?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically how I have been processing this book. When anyone speaks about codification, I, in my opinion, I think, you know, codification is basically neutral. So whatever it is, I try to address it directly to myself as a singular non-white black person and non-white people on a collective global basis, and how one can apply the codification. And from that aspect is the only reason why I would venture this book as being positive. To be able to transfer and process whatever that codification that this person is talking about. Because primarily, I would think he is basically, his main interest is probably addressing it solely from a perspective of a suspected racist or a racist white person, how they would be able to apply it. I thought that it was very interesting on Dr. Welzing's report. I've heard that before in the beginning, before the book reading even started, that she mentioned, and I agree with her, and it still is relevant, very, very relevant today, that if and when black males come into, you know, some sort of either meetings, or whether it's a mass, or whether it's three or four non-white black males, that the subject of fear should be constructively addressed in itself, to come up with methods, tactics, and strategies on how to deal with that phenomenon in a constructive way. And that's what I have to report. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I did have Dr. Welzing playing at the beginning of the program. Let's see. I'm just reading from
the web. I remember her. I remember her.
Well, wait a minute. I don't want to go too far afield. I don't want to go too far afield because this is not Dr. Welsinghour. We are on Gavin DeBecker. Did you have something else about
the book? No, that's it. Code is neutral. And so it's something that I can pay attention to and kind of pick up on some of the things that he is talking about in the book. Yes. Thank you.
So on that note of codification, as I said, I think a big part of his security empire is around code. And so Mosaic is one. It is a threat. It's Mosaic Threat Assessment Systems. So that's like its own entity. That's still Gavin DeBecker. So if you click on it, it has the different assessments for domestic abuse, student abuse, public figures. So if you click on it, it says the Mosaic system for assessing risks posed in the workplace with a male has restricted access. Generally, this Mosaic is made available to large corporations, institutions, government agencies, and universities. This Mosaic threat assessment is designed for evaluating the three major workplace hazards organizations face: the angry employee, the angry former employee, and the stalker who seeks out his victim at work. Access to this assessment is limited to organizations, entities responsible for assessing and managing these situations: human resources, legal security, or key members of a workplace violence or crisis management team. Qualified users can request additional information below. And so it's a pretty lengthy form that you have to fill out. I'll check really quick before I get our other callers. Is the domestic abuse? We'll check female offender just to see if it's available. Let's see. Register. So you have to register. It looks like this one is available publicly, but you have to register. I don't see a guest option, so it looks like you do have to register. But it looks like the domestic abuse assessment you can sign up for. I'll post the link for that if that would be of interest for anyone to check out. Let's see some of the other folks who dialed in. One of our participants at the Virginia Cows Anniversary Retreat should be coming to Florida in December. Miss TN, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. I do agree with plan ignoring. I think that does work. I was in a situation, it's been over a year ago. Me and my husband, we were headed to the grocery store and we were stopped at a stoplight. And we were stopped right next to a curb. And it was a driver. It was a white male and his wife. They were in a pickup truck. So we were in one lane. And the next lane next to us was not that it didn't have that many cars in that lane. And so instead of him waiting for the light change to get in the lane, he proceeded to drive up on the curb. And he, in the process of doing that, sideswiped my car. And so he sideswiped the car and he came to where he was going to. And then he act like he didn't hit sideswipe our car. And so my husband went up to his truck to, you know, like, hey, guy, you sideswiped us. And, you know, my husband was talking to him. And, you know, I just merely got out of the car. I took a picture of him, took a picture of his tag, and I got back in the car. And, you know, my husband was talking to him. And he said he was going to, you know, turn and he was going to pull over at the store and so we could exchange information. And so we pulled over at the store and we got out and my husband and I, and we were like looking at the damage that the guy had done to the car. And then he proceeded to get out of the car and confront us and saying to us, he didn't hit our car. And, you know, let me look at it. It's not that bad. And, you know, saying all of this stuff, you know, before we got out of the car to assess the damage at the store, I called the police. The police was on their way. And, he's talking to us, telling us, let him see the damage, you know, all this stuff. And I was telling, my husband was like, you know, getting angry and was getting ready to, you know, go back and forth with the guy. And I'm telling my husband, don't say a word. Don't say anything. And in the process of me saying all of this, I pulled out my camera. I pulled out my phone and started recording the situation. And this guy, he was like belligerent, and he got almost 3 inches from my face. And my husband was going to get ready to retaliate. And I'm screaming at him in the video, don't say a word, you know, don't do anything. And, you know, because the guy, they were up to no good. I was watching him. He's in my face. His wife, he whispered something to his wife. She's in the car. She got back in the truck and she's fumbling around. You know, I don't know if she's looking for a weapon. I don't know what she's doing, but I'm watching her. I'm quiet. I'm not saying anything, you know, surveying the area. And so he screamed something about you people, given the fact that he ran us over. And then he proceeded to go in the store and wait till the cops came. So I do think plan ignoring does work. Thanks.
Excellent job de-escalating in any of those like vehicle situations. Getting pics ASAP is, that's like mandatory, because I've like personally known non-white people who have been hit by racists, and they did the hit and run and just other terroristic things on the road. So definitely pictures and planning. That's why I said, like, hey, I frequently give this same recommendation on workplace racism. Sometimes that is the best thing to do. You do not need to say anything. You don't need to respond at all. I think one of the ways I frequently articulate it is sometimes no response, best response. Let's see, Mr. Demery 4, you should be with us if you have commentary. Lines should be open, Mr. Demery 4. I'm using a slightly different mouse today, and it is taking me a moment. There we go. Whew, it's all newfangled.
Yes, Rabbi Hurt.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering, I was having a little difficulty when I would press 6 and it would, you know, kind of go around in circles. I didn't know if I was on the queue or not. But, you know, what impressed me about the reading at first was this interaction between Tommy and Mike. You know, and I thought about it for a while. And, you know, it's obvious that Mike made some mistakes, and it just brings to light that, you know, as non-white black people, we rarely get jobs from these type of meetings. It was like networking, and then he's able to, you know, give his little pitch before the owner of the agency, and then secure an interview or a meeting with the guy that's running the whole show. That, you know, rarely happens, you know. So now this guy, although he got through to that point, that must have been, you know, the way that he conducts business. And it, you know, it seemed pretty normal to him. So he wasn't alarmed, and he kept leading the guy on. By the time that he realized that it was trouble and he had to go and see Mr. DeBecker, you know, he was excuse me, he was probably not too far away from Tommy getting violent. Excuse me, but I think that the way he's giving these scenarios and the chronological order is to reinforce his point of view. He said one thing about these people that harass, they'll push your buttons until one provokes a reaction, and then as long as it works, they keep pushing it. I learned from someone, I think it was a strategy to change your buttons around. If people are able to push certain buttons and get some type of reaction from you, change those buttons around on. And the trying to control other people's conduct, you know, I think that that's probably the, you know, the crust of all this. You never know what a person's going to do. And you have to assess each individual, I think, or individual incident differently. I say that because the environment, you may be in America, you know, where self-defense may be encouraged, aggression. But then again, you could be in a European country like Sweden and end up defending yourself and end up looking at time in jail like the rapper ASAP Rocky. But you have to be aware of where you are and then those moves that you make. And like you pointed out before, it's probably a good idea to do nothing at first because you can't possibly get it right when the incident is happening to you. And I think it was interesting, the last thing I say is when Mr. Hentley was killed when he was getting ready to cruise on his ship. The guy felt emasculated, you know, in front of his mother when the guys came. And so I think he did it right there on the cruise in front of his wife, you know, so he could have, well, I don't know, I can't put any reasoning on it because Jim Hentley didn't even know the guy. He didn't see it coming. But in his mind, you know, he felt justification for what he did. I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
I reckon if I could get a quick question, and you said you thought that Tommy might have been on the verge of violence before Mr. DeBecker was hired to come in and offer Mike some assistance. Why did you think Tommy was on the verge of violence? I thought he'd said he thought there wasn't much of a threat of violence specifically.
Well, it's been, you know, my experience. If he had met Mike before, knew Mike was running a 75-man travel agency, and then he calls him up and starts talking to him. It started out with respect, and then he started calling him an asshole and probably some more choice words. And Mike, I think at a point, did not feed into it. If he had started the name calling and maybe he took it there. You know, I think Tommy, in my opinion, was probably teetering on doing something, you know, if it had been the right situation. So that's just my assessment. I don't really know other than the fact that, you know, his language changed and then he started writing. And then the respect that he had for him went down. And then the fact that he wasn't making, you know, anything from his proposal. So I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. That is an important point. In the book, I thought, can't change how other people think frequently, much less how they behave. Draftomania, did you have comments here? You should be with us also.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for taking my call, Gus. Hello, callers and listeners. I think that to your question, the planned ignoring is a very good tactic to use. I just wanted to say that, you know, coming from, you know, violence, coming from like some of the neighborhoods and some of the areas where planned ignoring was not encouraged. It was perceived as being, for lack of a better word, being a coward or a punk. You know, had to defend yourself. You know, that was just the type of environment that a lot of us have come up in. And, you know, that type of trauma of being around that and growing up in that, you know, it can have you, you know, be acting and, you know, just in that reactionary mode all of the time. So learning how to respond as opposed to react is a very good thing, because it allows you not to not to be in, you know, get yourself involved in a whole lot of things that could basically be avoided. If you just, you know, ignore a situation, and, you know, I think a lot of it also has to do with ego. You know, you just don't want to appear to look like I just said, like a punk or like a coward. But, you know, once you can kind of like get your ego in check and like kind of like, you know, get to know who you are, and that, you know, no matter what's going on outside of you, like he did state, which I think is very, very important, is that like we cannot control other people's behavior. And, you know, when you do try to control other people's behavior, you're basically out of control. But like I said, I think that some environments do reinforce that type of aggression and those types of behaviors. So learning, because I have been practicing, practicing based on the show, a lot of candid warning. And it's been working. It's been getting me out of some situations that could have ended up into a competition that may not have been necessary. Also, I think that when he was talking about the guy that constantly harassed him and was making, you know, calling him, no, not calling him, but sending him letters and things like that, I have been in situations where I've been constantly harassed, and it can be very trying on your patience when you do want to just react. You do want to just, you know, do something about the situation. And I guess it just depends on your, I don't know, like if something is constantly being done to you on a daily basis, it can wear on you, and everybody has a breaking point. So it just depends on if, you know, what that breaking point is. It, you know, you may be good at it one day, but it can become a time where it's just getting so pressing that, you know, you may react in a way that's not for your best interest. So I think that the way he, when he did go about the situation by getting law enforcement and, involved, it didn't make matters better, it made matters worse. And it just, and I've seen that and I've experienced that also. When you try to do things in a proper manner, I just actually, she can't do this with that neighbor situation or whatever in other situations also. And, you know, you think that you're doing things and that's going to maybe stop the behavior from those other individuals. And all it does is it seems like it just escalates, and it's like pouring gasoline on the fire. So I think that it is, it's kind of hard sometimes to be able to assess what you know, what the necessary actions may be when you are being harassed and, you know, terrorized, you know. So I think, you know, I guess it's an individual thing. That's all I can share. Thank you.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Another vote for planned ignoring, or however you want to phrase it, but not responding. And I agree. I think that that is a strategy that I learned later in life. And it was not heavily promoted that, you know, and specifically using that language and, you know, deliberately not responding to things. Yeah, I have found that that can be very effective in a lot of different scenarios. One other thing I did want to comment on, like the two main incidents that he gave us with Mike and Tommy, Mike being the one who, I guess, was being victimized and Tommy being the persecutor. And then the Hicklin example, Tommy Edwards being the murderer in this one. I think both of these incidents, and again, I am not familiar with the Hicklin assassination. I never heard of this person, the assassin, any of this until today, even though he was, I guess, a media personality. It did happen before I was born, but, you know, I think both of these situations involve white perpetrators. I could be wrong. And again, he doesn't have footnotes. We just have to take, you know, what's on the page, what's in the audio recording. There are no footnotes or anything to support the narratives that are being given. But I'll look online and see what's there about the Hicklin assassination. If Edwards or Tommy were black or even non-white, do these scenarios change? That's a question I'll ask before we get to the second audio segment, because I'm even thinking about that. I'll start, I guess, with the second situation. So you got a black male, and maybe I'll look, maybe I'm wrong. I'll concede that I'm ignorant about this case. So if it was a non-white person who did this, I'll give you a mea culpa. For the time being, though, I think these are white folks, all of them. So if Edwards was black, you first get the detectives come to his residence. That alone, for a lot of black people, could cause problems. That could be housing problems, work problems. What? Who was coming here to investigate you? For what? You all can let me know if I'm being an heir there. And then he gets arrested. The police came to his house and arrested him for those letters in front of his mother. He said he felt emasculated. Just that arrest alone could have gone totally different. Many black people have been shot and killed just for a warrant for arrest. Fred Hampton, among a long list. Mark Clark, a long list of black people. Ayanna Stanley Jones. That arrest alone and him being detained, he didn't have bail. Just think of that. Khalif Browder, he didn't have bail. Couldn't get out of prison. That's what they said. That entire situation could have been totally different. I don't know how he got to the cruise boat, you know, with a firearm. I don't know. But I think that could have been a totally different situation if it were a black person. The first scenario with Tommy and Mike, if that is a black person, I'm not sure if a white man would tolerate that from a black person. It's difficult for me to imagine a white man allowing a black male to pester him and to pester other female employees of that matter, to call them up. When are you going to be quitting? Because I'm trying to get your job. That just is not computing for me logically in a system of racism, white supremacy. I guess that'll be my last question, folks that are here. Any thoughts on that? These scenarios, would they be any different if, assuming these are all white people, and anybody who thinks that these are non-white people, please speak up. But assuming these are white people, do we think these scenarios would be any different if they were black people, non-white people, as the perpetrators specifically?
Yes, I was going to say, of course you would. to me, that's like a no-brainer. That's common sense. Of course, the scenario would be totally different.
I think most definitely it would have played out differently if one of these had been a non-white black person, especially Tommy. And I didn't mention before, he had threatened to call up and reserve 30 different trips every month, and the guy wouldn't know which ones were real and which ones was fake. And that was the main thing that I was thinking. He was actually getting into action. So, and like you said, if Tommy had been a black person, none of that would have been tolerated. I mute my line.
That's what I was thinking. I could be totally wrong. If we have any folks live or in the archives at any point forward, we got, you know, ways to go before we get to the conclusion. I am looking online now, and Mr. Hicklin, it looks like, is definitely a white man. And I'm trying to just make sure I can confirm the photo of Mr. Edwards, but I think this is a white man as well. But I have not been able to confirm on that. But it looks like Jim Hicklin, definitely a white man. I'm trying to check for Tommy Edwards. The other ones, we only have last names, so I'm just going. But like I said, I just can't imagine. Is that feasible? Like, I can't see that. Like, in the 2000s, 1970s, 1950s, 1990s, 2020s, I cannot imagine, like, a white man with a business, and he's gonna, like, for months allow a black male or female to pester him on in, calling up on business time, calling and harassing other white female employees. I just cannot imagine that being tolerated under any context. I could be totally wrong, but, you know, please speak up if you think that's the case. Any other thoughts, comments, questions that stood out from the first audio segment?
Gus, would you say that was a bon voyage party that was going on where Mr. Hicklin was assassinated? Or did Ed book the cruise so that he could be laying in wait for him?
I don't know. Like I'm totally ignorant about this case. So, you know, everything is just, I'm guessing and just hearing from the first time today, probably like a lot of listeners. But he had already said, you know, he would come up with different schemes. It may have been that he had already booked a cruise and kind of prepared to kind of be laying for him, waiting for him to attack him. It seems like he was pretty calculating with his attack, like he was so focused. It said after the arrest incident where I guess they said he wasn't able to recover. But I mean, I'm ignorant. I'm just going, he doesn't have any footnotes. I'm ignorant. I'm just guessing. I wish I had at least got one article. I'm trying to look online to get more information to make, you know, some sort of assessment about, you know, how all that would have played out. What do you think?
Well, one thing, the book was pointing out that it was a group of friends there to say farewell. And it kind of gave me the impression that, you know, maybe some people that wasn't going to be on the ship was there for momentarily, you know, just to say goodbye. You know, similar to, I guess, a bon voyage party that celebrities do before they take off. So it's still up in the air. Maybe when we find more about the case, we'll know what actually happened.
I found a newspaper article But this is, you know, from 1973. Like, it's, this is not like, it doesn't seem to be, at least from my initial checkings, this is not a super popular case. I guess this is before the big social media boom. Media wasn't as big as it is now. This is before CNN even existed. Yeah, but it doesn't seem like there's, it seems like it's mentioned in other cases, but it's not, it doesn't seem like there's a prominent amount of information about this case. So I have to do a little digging. We'll have to see. It seemed that, maybe Mr. Taylor booked it and that was his plan from the beginning. Bon voyage, play on words type of thing. And whammo, I'm, you know, waiting to get him. White people, we do talk about that on a regular basis, system of racism, white supremacy. White people are conniving years in advance, 100, 500-year plans. Any other comments? Folks want to make sure they get in before we get to audio segment number two. I will assume folks are good. If you have additional thoughts, comments, questions, write them down. We should have ample time once the second audio segment concludes. We're resuming chapter 9. This again is The Gift of Fear: Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence. Gavin DeBecker, white male. Context of white supremacy. We will get to audio segment number two.
Chapter 9. Occupational Hazards. How much more grievous are the consequences of our anger than the acts which arouse it? Marcus Aurelius. Dear Laura, it's time to remove the kid gloves. It's my option to make your life miserable if that is what you really want. I told you if I get fired or lose my clearance, I can force you to go out with me. You asked me what I could do, kill you? The answer to that was, plus still is, no. If I killed you, you would not be able to regret what you did. I have your parents' address. So what if you run? I'm ready to follow. I'm selling my houses. I have closed my retirement fund, sold my stock. I can go real quick. Let's say you don't back down. Plus, pretty soon I crack under the pressure, plus run amok, destroying everything in my path until the police catch me, plus kill me. Take care, Rick. As you read this letter, your intuition cries out for more details. Who is Rick? Who is Laura? What is their relationship? Did he get fired? Your intuition tells you to be curious because more information means a better prediction. You want to know the context, but knowing just what's in the letter, you can still use the Jaka elements to see things the original readers did not see. It speaks of Rick's justification for violence, losing his job, his shrinking alternatives, taking off the kid gloves, the favorable consequences to violence, making Laura regret what she did, and his high ability. He has her parents' address, has sold off his possessions, and is ready to go. The man who wrote the letter is named Richard Farley, and the woman he wrote to is Laura Black. They met while employed at a high-tech Silicon Valley company called ESL, a subsidiary of TRW. Farley had asked Laura Black to go out with him, and when she declined, he refused to accept her rejections. The company tried several interventions to make him stop bothering her, but with each one, his harassment escalated. Eventually, it included death threats. He also sent along an enclosure with one letter that chillingly communicated her vulnerability. It was a key to the front door of her home. When supervisors at ESL told Farley that he'd be fired if he kept this up, his sinister reaction prompted one of them to ask him incredulously, "Are you saying that if you are fired, you will kill me?" "Not just you," Farley answered. Around this time, Laura reluctantly sought a restraining order against Farley. Her intuition about him was right on the mark when she told the court, I'm afraid of what this man might do to me if I file this action. Farley was fired from ESL and banned from the premises, but he came back one day with a vengeance. He passed through the access doors, literally through them, after blasting out the glass with one of the shotguns he'd brought along. He was also carrying a rifle and several handguns as he walked around the building furiously shooting at his former co-workers. When he finally found Laura Black, he shot her once with a rifle and left her bleeding on the floor. He shot 10 other people that day, 7 of whom died. Laura, though losing blood and consciousness, was able to crawl out of the building. Later, she told me, the restraining order was the catalyst that pushed him over the edge. I hesitated a long time before I went forward to get it, but the company urged me on. Ultimately, I was told that my reluctance might be impacting my advancement at work. That was when I finally said, okay, it's worth taking a chance. The shooting was the day before we were to appear in court with Farley to make the temporary restraining order permanent. But Laura spent that day and many more in the hospital. Farley spent that day and many more in jail. News people spent that day and many more reporting that Farley had just snapped and gone on a shooting spree. But that never, ever happens. Jaka has shown you that people don't just snap. There is a process as observable and often as predictable as water coming to a boil. Though we call it workplace violence, it's really every type of violence committed by every type of perpetrator. It's revenge killing, when an employee who feels humiliated or emasculated proves that he cannot be taken lightly. It is domestic violence, when a husband seeks out his wife at her work. It's date stalking, when the man who refuses to let go pursues his victim at her job. It's rage killing, when an employee, primed to do something big and bad, chooses to do it at work. The fear of violence at work is understandable because work is a place where many of us are forced to interact with people we did not choose to have in our lives. Fortunately, violence in the workplace offers many predictive opportunities, and there are almost always several people in a position to observe the warning signs. Still, as the cases show, obvious warnings are frequently ignored. The cases also show that it doesn't have to be that way. Though you may not recognize the name Pat Sherrill, he is one of the reasons that when you think of shooting sprees at work, you think of the U.S. Postal Service. The 44-year-old Oklahoma letter carrier was known to co-workers as Crazy Pat. In 1986, soon after his supervisors threatened to fire him, he came to work with something more than just his usual anger at his bosses. He brought along 3 pistols as well. Sherrill shot 20 co-workers, 14 of whom died, and then he killed himself. Contrary to the public perception that Sherrill helped cement, the statistics for violence by employees of the Postal Service are actually better than for most industries in America. It's just that with hundreds of thousands of full-time employees and nearly 1 million people affiliated with the service in some way, odds are they'll have more of everything: more failure, more medical problems, more creativity, more laziness, more kindness, more violence. There are shooting incidents at fast food restaurants more often than at post offices, but they're not reported as if part of some trend. This is not to say that Postal Service management style and strategies are everything they could be, but rather to debunk the myth that they are the worst in the nation. Though Sherrill's attack was a bloodbath, within the year, another angry employee would make it look like a minor incident by comparison. A U.S. Air employee named David Burke was the man in the news this time. After the incident, reporters learned plenty of things about Burke that U.S. Air could have benefited from knowing when they decided to hire him. He had a history that included drug trafficking, shoplifting, and auto theft, as well as violence toward his girlfriend. He had cut the wires in her car, beaten her, and threatened her with a gun. It had reached the point that she'd gotten a restraining order against him. Burke's troubling behavior went with him to work, where he left a death threat on the answering machine of his supervisor, Ray Thompson, whom he blamed for many of his problems. Burke insisted he was being singled out for racial reasons, and he was indignant when U.S. Air fired him for stealing $69. Another U.S. Air employee, with very poor judgment, lent Burke a .44 Magnum revolver. It would never be returned. When U.S. Air fired Burke, they failed to take back his airport ID badge, and he wore it on his last day alive. Because of that badge, the woman operating the metal detector waved Burke around it and said, "Have a nice day." He replied, "I'll have a very nice day." He then walked into Thompson's office and demanded his job back. Thompson said no, then cut the discussion short because he was flying to San Francisco. Soon after, Burke stood in line and bought a ticket for the same flight. Unlike the other passengers taking their seats on flight 1771 that afternoon, Burke didn't care where the plane was scheduled to go because he already knew where it would end up. After takeoff, he wrote a note on an air sickness bag. "Hi, Ray. I think it's sort of ironical that we end up like this. I asked for some leniency from my family, remember? And I got none. And you'll get none." At 22,000 feet, the flight crew heard two shots. Burke had just killed Ray Thompson. Seconds later, the plane's black box recorded three more shots, then some commotion, then a final shot. The tower tried to recontact the pilots, but the jet was no longer under their control. It was now under the firm control of gravity, as it made a 700 miles per hour descent into the ground. 43 people died instantly, making Burke the perpetrator of the single worst workplace violence tragedy in American history. The worst, but far from the last. We generally think of these shooting sprees as being committed by employees at large corporations or government agencies, but an increasing number are perpetrated by stalkers, patrons, and even college students. Several of our clients now are major universities. In years past, they would not have had these concerns, but violence finds its way into every institution of our culture, and people not expecting it are also not prepared for it. Often, the signs are all there, but so is the denial. For example, after some terrible on-campus violence, school officials will describe a perpetrator as having been a student in good standing. Such descriptions are meant to say, who could have known? But further inquiry always answers that question. The case of college student Wayne Lowe is an informative example. On the morning of the day he became famous, Wayne received a package at the college. A receptionist was suspicious about its contents. Suspicion is a signal of intuition, because of two words on the return address: Classic Arms. She correctly notified resident directors, who took the package to a regularly scheduled meeting with the dean, Bernard Rogers. Staff members wanted to open the package, which they thought might contain a weapon, but Dean Rogers said it would be improper for the college to interfere with the delivery of a student's mail. He did agree that a member of the staff could approach Wayne Lowe to discuss it. Wayne was allowed to pick up the package and take it to his room. Soon after, Trinka Robinson, the resident director of his dormitory, came and asked Wayne what was in his heavy little package. He refused to open it. She asked again, and he again refused, so she left. When she returned later with her husband, Floyd, the box had been opened. Wayne told them that it didn't contain a weapon, but rather three empty pistol clips and some other gun parts. There was also an empty ammunition box. He said he'd ordered some of the items as gifts and intended to use others himself. Apparently, electing to forget that Wayne had refused to open the package in Trinka's presence, Floyd Robinson was satisfied. He later described Wayne as very open with me and not at all defensive. This observation was meant to communicate that same old, who could have known? Even though by that point several people could have known. At around 9 p.m. that evening, an anonymous male caller told Trinka that Wayne had a gun and was going to kill her, her family, and others. Trinka took the threat seriously enough to call several school officials. She also immediately took her children to the home of a school provost. Her husband joined them there at around 9:30. They decided they would go and search Wayne's room. If they found a weapon, or if he resisted, they would call the police. But since Dean Rogers hadn't let them open Wayne's package, how would he react if they searched Wayne's room? Better call the dean, they decided. And that's what they were doing when they heard the first shots. By the time the loud noises stopped, 6 people had been shot. 2 of them were already dead. It had been less than 12 hours since Wayne had picked up the package that stimulated school officials to do everything except the obvious thing, call the police. Even the explicit warning call about Wayne's intentions hadn't convinced them to call the police. It was 10 more days before Dean Rogers made any public explanation, and people were anxious to hear what he knew about the incident. Instead, he told them what he did not know. I don't know anything about weapons. I don't know anything about guns. I'm sure Dean Rogers knew guns are dangerous, and I'm sure he knew there were people he could call about the matter. Given that so little about Wayne's feelings and perceptions was known to college officials, it would have been difficult to apply the Jocka elements. But this is a perfect example of a case in which context alone is the dominant element of prediction. A student receives a package from a gun manufacturer. He refuses to open it or discuss its contents. He then opens it when he is alone. Within hours, an anonymous caller warns that the student has a gun and plans to kill people. These things did not each happen independently. They all happened. And one could add another important factor. People felt intuitively that there was hazard. When Wayne Lowe appeared at his arraignment for murder, he wore a sweatshirt with the words, "Sick of it all," across his chest. That speaks my feelings about the many, many cases in which denial was allowed to turn into negligence, and in which people in a position to know were the same ones later asking, "Who could have known?" Having told several stories in which the warning signs were ignored and a tragedy occurred, I also want to acknowledge that the people involved, those who visited Edward Taylor to make him leave Jim Hicklin alone, those at Wayne Lowe's school, at Laura Black's company, at U.S. Air, even at the much-criticized U.S. Postal Service, were doing the best they could with the tools they had at the time. If they'd had the knowledge you now have, I believe they'd have made different choices, and thus my observations are not about blame, but about education. Park Dietz, the nation's leading forensic psychiatrist and an expert on violence, has noted that the case histories are littered with reports, letters, memoranda, and recollections that show people felt uncomfortable, threatened, intimidated, violated, and unsafe because of the very person who later committed atrocious acts of violence. One case Dietz studied tells a story of denial in its most undeniable form. A man killed one of his co-workers, served his prison time, was released, and was rehired by the same company whose employee he had murdered. While at the company the second time, he alienated people because he was always sullen and angry. He made threats that were known to supervisors, and he stalked a female co-worker. After he resigned, on the verge of being fired, he continued to stalk the woman, and then he killed her. Who could have known? Destructive acts against co-workers and organizations are not rare or isolated incidents. In an age of takeovers, mergers, and downsizing, with people frequently laid off or fired, employee emotion is a force to be reckoned with. The loss of a job can be as traumatic as the loss of a loved one. But few fired employees receive a lot of condolence or support. While the frequency of violent incidents has increased, most of the influencing factors have remained the same for a long while. Many American employers hire the wrong people and don't bother to find out a thing about them. Then employees are supervised in ways likely to bring out their worst characteristics. Finally, the way they are fired influences events as much as the fact that they were hired. Few people would knowingly light the fuse on a bomb, but many employers inadvertently do exactly that. Many come to me afterward, but only a few come wanting to learn about the topic before it's a crisis. I tell those clients about the most common type of problem employee, the one I call the script writer. He has several characteristics that are detectable early in his employment. One is his inflexibility. He is not receptive to suggestions because he takes them as affronts or criticisms of his way of doing things. Another characteristic is that he invests others with the worst possible motives and character. Entering a discussion about a discrepancy on his paycheck, for example, he says or thinks, "You'd better not try to screw me out of any money." It's as if he expects people to slight him or harm him. The script writer is the type of person who asks you a question, answers it himself, then walks away angry at what you said. In this regard, he writes the script for his interactions with coworkers and management. In his script, he is a reasonable and good worker who must be constantly on guard against the ambushes of coworkers and supervisors. The things that go wrong are never his fault, and even accidental, unintended events are the work of others who will try to blame him. People are out to get him, period. And the company does nothing about it and doesn't appreciate his contribution. When you try to manage or reason with such a person, you find that he's not reacting to what you say, but rather to what he expects you to say. He is reacting to his script. His is a personality that is self-defeating. The old Jack joke demonstrates this dynamic at work. A man driving along a remote stretch of highway gets a flat tire. Preparing to put on the spare, he realizes he doesn't have a jack to raise the car. Far in the distance, he sees the lights of some small farmhouses and begins the long walk to borrow a jack. It's getting dark, and as he walks along, he worries that the people will be reluctant to help him. They'll probably refuse to even answer the door, or worse still, pretend they're not home, he thinks. I'll have to walk another mile to the next house, and they'll say they don't want to open the door and that they don't have a jack anyway. When I finally get somebody to talk to me, they'll want me to convince them I'm not some criminal. And if they agree to help me, which is doubtful, they'll want to keep my wallet so I don't run off with their stupid jack. What's wrong with these people? Are they so untrusting that they can't even help a fellow citizen? Would they have me freeze to death out here? By this point, he's reached the first house. Having worked himself into a virtual state of rage, he bangs loudly on the door, thinking to himself, they better not try to pretend there's nobody home because I can hear the TV. After a few seconds, a pleasant woman opens the door wide and asks with a smile, "Can I help you?" He yells back at her, "I don't want your help, and I wouldn't take your lousy jack if you gift-wrapped it for me." The scriptwriter gives no credit when people are helpful, and this causes alienation from co-workers. His script actually begins to come true, and people treat him as he expects them to. By the time a given employer encounters him, he has likely been through these problems at other jobs and in other relationships. The script writer issues warnings. "You'd better not try to blame me for what happened," or "I'd better get that promotion." Even when he gets his way, he believes it's only because he forced the company to give it to him. He still thinks management was trying to get out of promoting him, but couldn't. When I review such an employee's personnel file, it's amazing how many serious performance or insubordination incidents are documented. Many are the kinds of things that companies could terminate for. He has made threats, he has bullied, he has intimidated. Sometimes the employee has even performed sabotage or already been violent at work. And yet he wasn't fired because everybody was afraid to fire him. Managers have generally shifted him around from department to department, or put him on a late shift, or done whatever it takes to make him somebody else's problem. Nobody wanted to sit down, look him in the eye, and fire him, because they knew he would react badly. Since this dynamic feeds on itself and gets worse, and because the longer he's there, the more he feels entitled to be there, the key is to get rid of a script writer early. I am not going into the quagmire of legally acceptable reasons for termination, but rather addressing those cases in which there is cause to fire someone and the decision to fire has been made. When you first have cause to terminate this person, it should be done. Be sure, however, that the cause is sufficient and that your determination is unshakable, because if you try to fire him and fail, you are setting the stage for the time syndrome, which is the introduction of threats, intimidations, manipulations, and escalation. Manipulations are statements intended to influence outcome without resorting to threat. Escalations are actions intended to cause fear, upset, or anxiety, such as showing up somewhere uninvited, sending something alarming, damaging something, or acting sinister. When dealing with a difficult and violently inclined employee, it's important to understand that time is on his side unless you act quickly. Management may correctly intuit that he will not go quietly, but the sooner in the process he is fired, the easier it will be. If you believe it will be hard to fire him now, you can be certain it will be even harder later. The scriptwriter is often someone who has successfully used manipulations or intimidations in the past. His employer has, in effect, trained him that these strategies work, and for this reason, he expects them to work again. When management does finally take the bold step of firing him, they're faced with a person who is shocked and who feels he's being treated unfairly. He may be partly right about the unfairness, because compared to all the things he has done that he didn't get fired for, the cited reason may appear petty. He's angry, threatening, and cannot be appeased. When manipulations that have worked for him in the past appear not to work now, he escalates them. At this point, management must consider all the harms this person could do to the company or its personnel. When they saw this side of him before, they always retreated. This time, they've stood their ground, and he has upped the ante by saying or doing things that make clear the obvious. They should have fired him long ago. Before I provide some pins that are a call for further scrutiny in the workplace, I want to explain that I generally avoid the use of checklists because they mislead people into believing that there are shortcuts for high-stakes predictions. I've waited until this point in the book, when you are familiar with predictive resources and philosophies, before providing a list of behaviors. In less prepared hands, it could be misused. In yours, it will inform intuition. 1. Inflexibility. The employee resists change, is rigid and unwilling to discuss ideas contrary to his own. 2. Weapons. He has obtained a weapon within the last 90 days, or he has a weapons collection, or he makes jokes or frequent comments about weapons, or he discusses weapons as instruments of power or revenge. 3. Sadness. He is sullen, angry, or depressed. Chronic anger is an important predictor of more than just violence. People who experience strong feelings of anger are at increased risk of heart attack. In fact, anger supersedes even such risk factors as smoking, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. Such people place others at risk and are at risk themselves. Accordingly, chronic anger should never be ignored. Signs of depression include changes in weight, irritability, suicidal thoughts and references, hopelessness, sadness, and loss of interest in previously enjoyable activities. 4. Hopelessness. He has made statements like, "What's the use? Nothing ever changes anyway. I've got no future." He makes suicidal references or threats, or he makes or describes plans consistent with committing suicide, gets his affairs in order, sells off possessions, etc. Pessimism is an important predictor of problems, just as optimism is an important predictor of success. 5. Identification. He identifies with or even praises other perpetrators of workplace violence. He refers to, jokes about, or is fascinated with news stories about major acts of violence. He is attracted to violent films, magazines like Soldier of Fortune, violent books, or gruesome news events. 6. Co-worker fear. Co-workers are afraid of or apprehensive about him, whether or not they can articulate their reasons. This pin seeks to capture the intuition of co-workers. 7. Time. He has used threats, intimidations, manipulations, or escalations toward management or co-workers. 8. Paranoia. He feels others are out to get him, that unconnected events are related, that others conspire against him. 9. Criticism. He reacts adversely to criticism, shows suspicion of those who criticize him, and refuses to consider the merits of any critical observations about his performance or behavior. 10. Blame. He blames others for the results of his own actions, refuses to accept responsibility. 11. Crusades. He has undertaken or attached himself to crusades or missions at work. This is particularly significant if he has waged what he might characterize as a one-man war. 12. Unreasonable expectations. He expects elevation, long-term retention, an apology, being named the winner in some dispute, or being found right. 13. Grievance. He has a grievance pending, or he has a history of filing unreasonable grievances. 14. Police encounters. He has had recent police encounters, including arrests, or he has a history that includes assaultive or behavioral offenses. 15. Media. There have recently been news stories about workplace violence or other major acts of violence. Press reports on these subjects often stimulate others who identify with the perpetrators and the attention they got for their acts. Like public figure attacks, major incidents of workplace violence tend to come in clusters, with perpetrators often referring to those who preceded them in the news. 16. Focus. He has monitored the behavior, activities, performance, or comings and goings of other employees, though it is not his job to do so. He has maintained a file or dossier on another employee, or he has recently stalked someone in or out of the workplace. Since nearly half of all stalkers show up where their victims work, companies are wise to learn about this dynamic. 17. Contact. If he was fired, he has instigated and maintained contact with current employees. He refuses to let go and appears more focused on the job he just lost than finding other employment. While no single pin can carry a prediction, and not all serious cases will contain the entire list, these are some warning signs to be alert to. Most of us know or have known people who have a few of these characteristics, but if you work with someone who has many, that's a matter for further attention. When managers and supervisors and co-workers know these warning signs, they're far more likely to detect a serious situation before it becomes a critical situation. Park Dietz brought his brilliant thinking to a multi-year study of workplace violence incidents. After that, he and I produced and wrote a video training series used by many corporations and government agencies. The comment we heard back most frequently from organizations using the program was that spotting these employees early was far easier than they expected. They also said that the most common resolution of these situations was counseling problem employees, not firing them. Counseling was possible because they recognized early the fact that a given employee needed help. After studying every major incident of multiple shooting in the workplace, Dr. Dietz concluded, "If a company is going to be able to respond to the kinds of things that the employees felt were really predictive, they have to learn about them. It takes time to encourage employees to tell supervisors when someone makes them feel uncomfortable or apprehensive. It takes planning." But when the call comes that someone is shooting in Building 16, it's too late to do that planning. His study also confirmed my beliefs about the relationship between media reporting and workplace violence. It is a pattern that has increased in frequency and is so dependent on media that we can anticipate after each nationally publicized story, there will be several more in the weeks that follow. The reason for that is the people who commit these acts are searching for solutions to their dilemmas. When they see a news account of someone doing the things they feel like doing, who seems like them, they identify with such people. And this is part of what causes them to move from inaction to action. Many situations that evolved into violence had been brewing for a long time, and senior executives had no idea what was going on. Why? Because nobody wanted to report it to a supervisor. Why? Because someone might say, "Hey, can't you handle your own people? Don't you know how to deal with these things?" I had a meeting a couple of years ago with a client who is the CEO of a large national company. During a discussion about restaurants owned by the company, I said, "You must have had plenty of circumstances where female employees had to deal with unwanted pursuit or stalking." He replied, "I heard about one of those cases, but it really hasn't been a serious problem for us." A couple of hours later, I asked the human resources director, and he said, "Oh, sure, we've had about 6 or 7 of those cases in the last year. They can sometimes be a problem." Then he called the executive in charge of the restaurant division, who said, "We probably have 2 of those a month. I can think of about 20 we've had in recent years. It's a very serious problem." If managers never get an opportunity to comment on or to influence a situation that might be relevant to safety, then critical decisions are left in the hands of people who are only making them because they think their bosses want them to, or because they're afraid to tell anybody they can't. Companies can stimulate reporting by communicating that they want to know, and by welcoming information even when it's bad news. In some companies, if a manager makes a prediction that an employee's alarming or disturbing behavior might escalate, and he brings this to his seniors, he runs the risk of being perceived as wrong for overreacting and wrong for not being able to handle the matter himself. Most unfairly, he may be perceived as wrong every day that nothing happens. I propose that large organizations redefine the word wrong in this context to include just 3 criteria. A manager is wrong only if he or she, 1, doesn't consider safety first, 2, doesn't ask the right questions, 3, doesn't communicate concerns clearly and early. I'm fortunate to work with some forward-thinking companies that tell their managers, in effect, "We don't expect you to handle these behavioral sciences issues. We don't expect you to know about how to manage people that are alarming or volatile. If you can manage 95% of the people you are dealing with, that's an accomplishment. The 5% that depart from normal behavior, those that intimidate, threaten, or frighten, they should be reported to us." Difficult terminations and situations involving threatening employees are similar to other volatile social situations. These include divorce, disputes with neighbors, disputes with financial institutions, acrimonious lawsuits, and dissolving partnerships. What they all have in common is that the interests of one party are in direct conflict with the interests of another party. Accordingly, resolutions that are completely satisfactory to all parties are rare. To complicate matters, the difficult employee often has similar problems away from work as well. The good things in his life are like dominoes that have started to topple. Confidence has toppled into performance, which topples into identity, which knocks over self-esteem. The loss of his job may knock over the few remaining dominoes, but the one that employers must be careful not to topple is the dignity domino, because when that falls, violence is most likely. Consider JACA. Justification. The employee can feel justified in using violence when the employer has taken everything away. Alternatives. He may perceive fewer and fewer alternatives to violence particularly if he has exhausted all appeals processes. Consequences. His evaluation of the consequences of violence changes as he sinks lower. If he feels angry enough, particularly if he feels humiliated, the consequences of violence may become favorable. Ability. Often, angry current or former employees overestimate their ability to deliver violence. This is dangerous, because they're more likely to try grandiose attacks intended to kill everyone or to blow up everything. Though they rarely succeed at quite the level they envision, they still hurt plenty of people. The failure to take the obvious step of calling references is an epidemic in America, and I have little patience for managers who complain about employees they didn't care enough to assess before hiring. A common excuse for this failure is that the references will say only good things since the candidate has prepared them for the call. In fact, there is a tremendous amount of information to be gained from references in terms of confirming facts on the application. Did you know him when he worked for such and such a firm? When did he work for such and such a firm? Do you know roughly what salary he was making? Do you know what school he went to? You said you went to school with him. I suggest that questions asked of those listed as references be guided by information on the application. The most important thing references can give you are other references. We call these developed sources. These are people who know the applicant, but whom he did not list as references. Accordingly, they are not prepared for your inquiry and will be more likely to provide valuable information. You get the names of developed sources by asking the references the applicant listed for the names of the other people who know him. The interview with the applicant is another opportunity to gain valuable background information. This may seem obvious, but many employers don't use this best resource. The first issue to explore is an applicant's truthfulness during the pre-employment process. When people lie on applications, they rarely recall exactly how they lied, so I suggest holding the application in your hand and asking questions right off it as you interview a candidate. The most common lie is about the duration of previous jobs. 8 months is reported as a year, 18 months as 2 years, etc. During pre-employment interviews, which can be videotaped, there are a series of questions we suggest asking. Though not an exhaustive list, here are some examples. Describe the best boss you ever had, and describe the worst boss you ever had. This is a powerful inquiry that can reveal important attitudes about managers and management. If the applicant speaks for just a moment about his best boss, but can wax on enthusiastically about the worst bosses, this is telling. Does he use expressions like personality conflict to explain why things didn't work out with previous employers? Does he ridicule former bosses? Does he take any responsibility for his part? Tell me about a failure in your life and tell me why it occurred. Does the applicant say he cannot think of one? If he can describe something he perceives as a failure, does he take responsibility for it or does he blame others? E.g., I never graduated high school because those damn teachers didn't know how to motivate me. What are some of the things your last employer could have done to be more successful? Does the applicant offer a long list of items and appear to feel he could have run things better than management did? Are his comments constructive or angry? There is a follow-up. Did you ever tell your previous employer any of your thoughts on ways they could improve? If he says yes, but they never listen to anyone, or, yeah, but they just said mind your own business, this may tell more about the style of his approach than about managers at his last job. Most employers react well to suggestions that are offered in a constructive way, regardless of whether or not they follow them. Another unfavorable response is, what's the use of making suggestions? Nothing ever changes anyway. Some applicants will accuse former employers of stealing their ideas. Others will tell war stories about efforts to get a former employer to follow suggestions. If so, ask if this was a one-man undertaking or in concert with his coworkers. Sometimes an applicant will say his coworkers didn't have the guts to confront management like I did. What are some of the things your last employer could have done to keep you? Some applicants will give a reasonable answer, slightly more pay, better schedule, etc. But others will provide a list of demands that demonstrate unreasonable expectations. E.g., they could have doubled my salary, promoted me to vice president, and given me Fridays off. How do you go about solving problems at work? Good answers are that he consults with others, weighs all points of view, discusses them with involved parties, etc. Unfavorable answers contain a theme of confrontation. E.g., I tell the source of the problem he'd better straighten up, or I go right to the man in charge and lay it on the line. Another bad answer is that he does nothing to resolve problems, saying, nothing ever changes anyway. Describe a problem you had in your life where someone else's help was very important to you. Is he able to recall such a situation? If so, does he give credit or express appreciation about the help? Who is your best friend, and how would you describe your friendship? Believe it or not, there are plenty of people who can't come up with a single name in response to this question. If they give a name that was not listed as a reference, ask why. Then ask if you can call that friend as a reference.
Context of white supremacy. That will do it for the second audio segment. We will pick up. We are still in chapter nine. Unfortunately, we did not get all the way to the end. It's kind of a longer chapter. We're about halfway done, so we'll pick up, or I guess a little bit beyond the halfway point, but we still got a ways to go. Anywho, impromptu workplace racism segment. We'll be here tomorrow to continue with the same subject matter, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Yikes. if other folks have questions, comments, thoughts on the second audio segment, the portion of Chapter 9 that we heard, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you did not get to participate during the first portion of the program, make sure you dial in. Don't wait till the last minute. If you want to chime in, go ahead and get your hand up immediately. I really wish this portion of the book had footnotes. It would make it much, it would be a much more informative read, because some of the incidents that he is mentioning, these are like well-known events. I guess I can perhaps, Yeah, it would have been much better if he had footnotes. That, moving forward, I was reading and he was talking about David Burke. I haven't recognized any of these cases, even though some of these cases are very well known. I have not been familiar with any of them thus far. So he was talking about David Burke. And I say, I don't know about this. And I actually, my thought was, wow, this guy got fired and he was able to get back on the plane and do this shooting, take the whole plane down, because he was fired, but he still had his employee badge. And I said, wow, that sounds like something a white person would be able to get away with. You know, they still got their credentials and pat them down. They don't go through all the hassle and groping. And so he was able to get on with his firearm and do all this damage, kill all these people. But I check, David A. Burke is a black male, born to Jamaican parents, they say. They have quite a bit of information on Mr. Burke. So I was wrong. It was not a white person. I had to do some digging. And he did, in fact, mention several of the perpetrators that he mentioned appear to be non-white. Wayne Lowe as well. StoryCorps did a report on Mr. Lowe, and he's speaking to some of the parents, family members of the victims that he killed. But he mentioned quite a few non-white people in the second portion of the audio that we heard. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, questions to share, proceed. If we have any folks who've not participated at all, feel free. Ms. Tien, Mr. Demi Four, retired firefighter, should be with us. Draftomania as well.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Ford.
Okay. Well, the last thing you mentioned that there were several non-white people mentioned in the second reading. I kind of figured that Mr. Burke was probably a black person because the book mentioned that he mentioned it briefly that there was some racial tension, you know, and I bet you if we investigated, you know, close, he's probably, you know, terrorized before he got to that point. But anyway, I guess this Wayne Lowe may have been a non-white person too. But, you know, what struck me is while he was given this list of individuals, well, he talked about the script writer, you know, which, I don't know any, well, I guess we all probably know some people like this. But when he started talking about the pens, and he named off about 17 of them. But I know a guy that fits in about 5-6 of these. And if he hadn't been doing number 16, where he monitored the behavior and activities and performance of other employees and maintained the file and dossier on his managers, you know, this says employees, but this guy had like 1,000 dossiers of the manager. And, you know, he had filed previous grievances and all that. He walked around with clipboard all the time. And not only did he have recently purchased firearms, but he had a firing range. And he made his own his own ammunition. So, but to make a long story short, if he hadn't done some of the things he did, when they fired him, he would not have been able to fight for over a year for his job, and he eventually won, and they had to give him all his back pay and bring him back to his job. Now he's still walking around the job with that clipboard, but he don't have to do anything. I talked to him recently. He said, they unsigned me. Nothing to do. I'm just walking around. I was like, well, I don't know about that either, man, but I'm glad he got his job back. He was fired for an accident. And if it's an accident's an accident. As long as it's reported, that should be sufficient. But they were waiting on some reason to try to get rid of. See, a lot of this sounds like he's giving ammunition to supervisors or managers on how we get rid of people. You know, a lot of this stuff, like sadness, that may be because of all the terrorism that he's experiencing on the job from the managers. And then this part about managers are usually open to suggestions of the employee. I doubt that. You know, it's just not, it hadn't been my experience, you know. And they actually don't want you bringing it up. I mean, to them, it seems as though you're telling them how to do their job. So, these questions that he wants people to ask all the employees after he finished with that, I mean, they all sound like good questions, but I wonder how many employees you're going to have when you get through with all these questions, man. Because people are going to bomb on these questions. If they're honest, I don't see how he's going to have a work crew. But I'll mute my lines on that. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Ford. That was the exact language that I had in my brain computer when he was talking about, do you make suggestions on the job, or, you know, just say, yeah, I did, but they didn't listen, or whatever. For some people, it might be, no, I didn't, you know, didn't want to seem like I was telling them, you know, how to run the company, like get fired. Like, I'm trying to make sure I maintain my job and salary and everything. But great points, Mr. Demery. It did seem like he was giving out more information on how managers or supervisors, employers can fire employees. It did seem that way. Maybe that was intentional. Maybe that was what he wanted to do. Like, maybe he's concluded that there are a lot of violent and or potentially violent employees who need to be fired. That seemed like that was kind of how he started, right? He was talking about the postal shootings and then fast food restaurants and all of that. So maybe that is being done intentionally for a reason. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, *61 if you have comments. Line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, when he gave, like, I guess his checklist of things that the 17 items that he mentioned, you know, and a lot of that stuff kind of reminds me of, you know, like somebody's being mistreated on their job, you know, and, you know, they're just keeping a workplace racism journal, you know, and a lot of that kind of hinted about that. And then when, like, Mr. Demery Ford said with the questions, you know, he was insisting that employees' acts of their employer, employer's acts of the employees that they hire, you know, it's like those questions are questions that, you know, somebody that's been mistreated on their job is like things that they would remember that happened during the mistreatment. It's like questions geared towards, you know, I guess, invoking anger in people and, you know, and people telling you about the trauma or the hardships they experienced on a job in which they were mistreated. Thanks.
Much obliged, Ms. Tien. Workplace racism is Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Exactly, some of that did sound like workplace racism in terms of being in kind of a terroristic environment that might make you feel hopeless or sad about the predicament that you're in. I can totally see that. Grievance as well. Quite a bit. Grievance, even that, when I talk about that on workplace racism, almost on a weekly basis, to not use grievance. I don't have any grievance. I might make a report about misconduct, but I don't have a grievance. Watch that word if it's being applied to you. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, comments. While folks are getting their thoughts together, when he talked about, I guess, if you are interviewing a potential applicant, job applicant, and he was talking about references and people not checking references. This is one of those that I've talked about with regards to the system of racism, white supremacy. I'm not saying that every white person is able to get a job and not provide references. But I have said before that I think sometimes in the system, those guidelines are not enforced as stringently, especially in situations where they don't have to be. I easily see that being the case. That's why I thought that initially with David A. Burke, even though he is a black male. But I thought that my mind immediately went to Timothy McVeigh. He bought some of the explosives for the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. They did not require identification for the purchase. Josh Wickett wrote a counter-racist review talking about that component of white supremacy racism where, you know, black people go to cash, you know, a $20 check or something minuscule, not for explosives, and it's a you got, you know, blood, got to do a blood check, got to get a urine sample, got to do a retina scan and go through all of this. And I just don't think the rules are applied in the same manner, system of racism. But those screening, right, for potential applicants, not only do I think it's that a lot of white people get through this when maybe they don't have to provide references or they can cheat. We got all that cheating scams and everything. They can use their friends and such. I also think in that process, they said it was if they give you the references, make sure you check them. That's your duty. He had that in like boldface print. But then he said names of it was other people that you might not have listed as a reference. That was another component. And I thought, wow, now that's interesting, because that might end up being people that you may not necessarily have worked with. That, you know, it's just I didn't list this person. I didn't think of them as a work reference or what have you, even though we do have a relationship, blah, blah, blah. That would be interesting. And that I was kind of thinking what Mr. Demi-Four said, like, wow, like what sort of, you know, information if you're able to call all these people randomly, like random associates and what have you that you have not told to be expecting a call, like, and you can, you know, call and ask these people all kinds of wacky questions, like, and especially if they don't know it's attached to an interview, like that is, wow. I wonder if people are employing that strategy. I guess if we have any folks, if you've applied for a job, whether you got it or not, if you found out later on that people checked, I guess, not just the references that you provided for the job, but then, like, you know, just in this sort of manner, like other friends or associates and that sort of thing also contacted random unlisted references for a job. Let's see some of the other things I highlight. He has this in boldface print and in italics. Checking references and checking with former employers is an absolutely critical duty of every employer. And a lot of that related to the sexual history pattern of sexual misconduct on the job. If anything, one helpful tidbit and something that I mentioned on workplace racism on a weekly basis and will continue to do so, and it applies to racism in general, report incorrect behavior. He said that that was something in terms of changing the context of the word wrong. Reporting incorrect behavior is a big crucial aspect of that. We'll make sure I go back. He says, I propose that the larger organizations redefine the word wrong in the context to include just three criteria. A manager is wrong only if he or she, one, doesn't consider safety first, doesn't ask the right questions, doesn't communicate concerns clearly and early. I think I've been emphasizing safety and saying that in a workplace context on a regular basis when things come up about safety in the workplace. It's not, you know, I feel uncomfortable or not, I don't like this, or I thought it was insensitive, unsafe. Asking questions, that is a huge component of what we talk about every workplace racism, and then communicating concerns clearly and early. Reporting violations, potential problems. Talk about that all the time. Speaking up, at least it can be on record that I reported that this could be a problem. And he said specifically, he said many situations that evolved into violence had been brewing for a long time, and senior executives had no idea what was going on. Why? Because nobody wanted to report it to a supervisor. Why? Because someone might say, hey, you can't handle your own people. Don't you know how to deal with these things? There might be a litany of excuses, but I'm always a big advocate. I say it, workplace racism, all the time about reporting incorrect behavior. He had a list. Excuse me. He had a list of pens, things that you're looking for that might be potential problems, hazards in the workplace. The number two on the list, I don't know if these, it doesn't say that these are in, you know, order of most important, but I mean, it could just be a random list in no particular order. But number two on the list is weapons. He says he or she has obtained a weapon within the last 90 days, or she has weapons, a weapons collection, or he makes jokes or frequent comments about weapons, or she discusses weapons as instruments of power or revenge. I think that's important because on workplace racism, it came up last week. In fact, we had a caller. She said it was her daughter, 21 years old, and she had a white male on the job who was making comments about firearms and what have you, and firearm literature and what have you. Same, exactly what I just read. Exactly what I just read. And he has that as number two on the list of, uh-oh, this might be someone to watch. Might want to be alert about this person. This could be a potential problem. And in fact, this is incorrect. I don't, what did I just say? Safe. I don't feel safe in the workplace. That's the way it should be reported, articulated. But I thought that was hugely important because this comes up all the time. So many people report that they have white people that they work with who, everything I just said, they're talking about firearms, selling firearms. They got the magazines and what have you. Everything that I just read, they talk about this regularly on our broadcast tomorrow. And what should be done about that? Should that be reported? Safety. It is a safety issue, and that is not conduct, the culture of a professional and safe work environment. Let's see. He also, at number five, he said, identifies with or even praises other perpetrators of workplace violence. He refers to, jokes about, or is fascinated with news stories about major acts of violence. He is attracted to violent films, magazines like Soldier of Fortune, violent books, or gruesome news events. I feel like that is the entirety of the system of white supremacy. Every job that I've been on, people have joked, bragged about violent movies, talked about different shooting incidents that have gone on, the O.J. Simpson murder trial. I mean, who? That's every job. That's the culture of racism, white supremacy, is to talk and joke about violence, violent films, violent movies, violent cartoons. That's what everything is about. Nigger jokes included. Let's see. While I'm double checking other folks, going through my notes, other folks that we missed entirely. Any other folks have comments, questions they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Dropped a mania.
Okay, I'm sorry about that, Gus. What happened was my phone, it only lasts for 2 hours from the call, so it dropped, so I had to give you a call back in. I wanted to make a comment about when he was talking about firing one of the coworkers that he was, I think he was given a list of different things that you should look out for. And I was kind of thinking, like, if you know that one of your coworkers are, they're, you know, angry and seem to be troublesome, or it could be a potential threat, my suggestion would be, I was thinking that maybe it would be good to be able to take some days. Like, if you was to find out that coworker got fired, and you know that they could maybe come in and do something, they was making threats and doing things like that, I would try to take time off, you know, because I just wouldn't want to be caught in that situation as being the victim, like he described throughout the program with some of those people that ended up. I think he was talking about the woman, Laura, who I guess he only just shot her, wounded her, but the others he does, I'm not sure exactly what the guy's name was that went in and killed all his coworkers. And the next thing was this does remind me of workplace racism. The caller last week, she called in and she was discussing how her coworkers, or I'm not sure if she was just new on the job or whatever the situation was, but the guy that was sitting there just perusing the gun magazines, you know, on the job. And, you know, that should definitely be something that should be taken seriously. He's given us all these examples about the violence in a workplace. So I just don't see how people can come to work and, you know, be able to, like, look at those types of magazines and that not be a red flag for employers. That should be something that the employer should take seriously. And if they don't, that should definitely be a red flag to, you know, the employee. And the next thing was when he was discussing the incident with the college student and how there was definite signs that this student you know, purchased the gun. I mean, you would think that on a school campus that those would be some of the things that, you know, those would be red flags and things that they would pay attention to. Not sure, you know, what the color of the students was, but I'm assuming that they were suspects. And it was just, to me, it was just totally amazing how many signals that they had, and they just, you know, they just, you know, made all these excuses why they shouldn't investigate it further and didn't even call the cops. I suspect if it was a non-white black person, oh, the cops would have been called immediately. So it's just, you know, and it kind of puts me in mind of the Las Vegas incident with the guy that shot up all those people also. You know, he comes into the hotel, he has all these weapons. It's like all the obvious things that if we was to do that, those types of things, the police have been called on us for lesser things, you know. But these, all these red signs, red flags, and they just, it just goes under the radar until something happens. So I just think that Texas teaching us as victims that we should definitely, as you stated before, definitely pay attention to the signs. Never minimize and always pay attention to your intuition, because I believe that your intuition is a gift from your ancestors and the creator to that's trying to give you, you know, make you pay attention to what's going on in your surroundings. And that's all I have.
Much obliged, Draftomania. They have an interesting report on Time, David Burke's Deadly Revenge, talking about the airplane being shot down. Trust your intuition. I think that is also a major point of the book. Pay attention to your intuition. There are signs. People do not snap. He said that specifically this week in the portion we read. People do not snap in these violent events. Generally, there are signs, cues, things where you can pay attention and see that, oh, yeah, there was a context to why this happened. Generally speaking, pay attention to your intuition. He mentioned context quite a bit in this week's portion as well. We only have a few minutes left. If folks have a final comment, I was just going to say really quick, do folks think it might work? This was number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list at one point. They've got a 10-year anniversary of the book, and Mr. DeBecker is, like I said, he's working for Jeff Bezos, doing security for him as of, you know, right now. Do people think on the job that could be a workplace racism strategy if they got an employee, a coworker, who is making gun references, flipping through, you know, The Rifleman or some other firearm magazine and what have you, making jokes about firearms and that sort of thing on the job? Do people think you could say, hey, I don't feel safe around this? Gavin DeBecker wrote that book talking about things to be mindful of in the workplace. And, you know, number 2 on the list was weapons. And, you know, it's the exact behavior that Mr. DeBecker wrote about is being exhibited by old Ted here or whatever, you know, whatever his name is. Do people think that referencing this book might work? Especially if you're talking to a white person, they might even know of Mr. DeBecker. Do people think you could mention this book to maybe help your case?
I can chime in on that and say, not no, but hell no, because that's what goes on in the workplace. I was talking, there was a lady getting ready to retire, and she was about 66 or 67, and she was overweight, little white lady, and there was some news came on. And I made a statement say, it looked like it's going back to the Wild Wild West. And she looked at me and said, when did it ever stop?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. So you see the magazines, NRA, and all of the talk about violence. And so that wouldn't work, I don't think. I'll mute my line.
Dang. No help.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Yes, I
did a better job of listening to the second reading. And what I gather from it, and I kind of like juxtapose it to my career on Dade County Fire Department, which I started in the early 80s, right after the McDuffie Rebellion. When I went out from training, even before I went out into the field, even in training, I had understood that Dade County Fire Department hired a lot of veterans who did active combat in Vietnam. That was the quote unquote closest major war the white people in this part of the world involved themselves in. And the reason why I mention that is because along with that, the persons, there was a lot of psychological problems that was in people who have done active combat, especially in that particular war, because even other white people were in debate about the issue in itself. And all you have to do is look at Ken Burns and his report on Vietnam. So you'll get a gambit of issues involving white people, especially the ones who did, like I said, active combat. So everything that the author of this fear book is talking about, I was seeing on a daily basis as far as all of these different ingredients that he's talking about. When he described the I'm assuming it was a white male or white males in general, as far as their behavior, whether they are firefighters or some sort of management, particular personnel, and the potential to just show up on a job and just start killing coworkers was always available because of the psychological damage they already had when they was coming into the job. And of course they wasn't going to turn down no huge pursuit of white males coming to get a quote unquote job, you know, with the GI Bill they have and all of that stuff. And the whole idea about America, rah, 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 patriotism and whatnot. They were going to hire those white males. You have to examine some of the signs of it. I never was really confronted with any issues directly. But you know, you hear the attitude, you hear the discourse in the fire station, you hear rumors about the behavior of certain people. He's crazy. He did time in Vietnam, blah, 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 that sort of thing. And it wasn't unusual for white males to bring their firearms, not only to work, but to bring the firearm into the fire station and do things like cleaning it, you know, that sort of thing. You know, I can recall one time that happened amongst myself and Mr. Clark and several other less confused non-white black males, and we brought a gun in retort and did the same thing. In other words, they were attempting to quote unquote intimidate us, you know, by carrying on this type of activity. So we decided to divert against it, bring a firearm in and then start cleaning it also. Let you know, okay, well, if that's what you want, then you're going to get this in return as far as that concerned. But nevertheless, it had to be in hundreds of people like this is what I'm saying on this job, because that was the quote unquote major war. You know, after I would say after Vietnam, you had smaller battles that the system of racist white supremacy from this part of the world engaged in, like Grenada. Then you're talking about in the late 80s, early 90s, after 9/11. But the numbers were
30 seconds.
You know, just the situation, whereas they hired a lot of those people. That's all. Thank you.
Much obliged. retired firefighter. No surprise at all to hear about the conduct of the firefighters, armed firefighters, and cleaning the weapon on the job at the fire station. Safety first. Or I guess that's the first order of business as a firefighter. Safety first means make sure your gun has been cleaned and oiled. That's safety first. Then we'll get to, you know, the fire hoses and all the rest.
Trying to intimidate somebody, yes.
The cows. We did our book club for the day, hanging tough, not feeling best, but hey, that is the system of white supremacy. Do the best you can. We will be here tomorrow for workplace racism, even though it feels like we had workplace racism today. Eight same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I am sure planned ignoring will be mentioned tomorrow, and maybe we'll even have some different strategies for how to deal with whites and their firearm culture in the workplace. If you have thoughts, questions on the text, we have some ways to go before we get done. So you can drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. We can include your commentary as we proceed. Much obliged to all the folks who participated live. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Racists have taken advantage of many victims of racism when we were not thinking correctly as a result of their narcotics. Let us preserve our brain computer. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver, or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That includes not being on the cell phone if you are driving. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.